Welcome to Linux Slugcast. We are an open podcast / slug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or at least that's what we shoot for, every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. If you'd like to join us, please visit linuxslugcast.com for the server details. We also have a Mumble how-to on the site explaining how to configure Mumble. Then just join us in the Linux Slugcast room. During the live show, if you're unable to join us in Mumble, you can listen to us streaming live. You can also join us in IRC anytime on Freenode and the hash Linux Slugcast channel. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you would like us to discuss, please email us at feedback@linuxslugcast.com. And bear with us. We are still having some transitional difficulties, I believe. We also have a Google Plus community site and a mail list. Visit our website for the direct links. Hello, this is Linux Slugcast episode 106. And we had some scheduling difficulties 2 weeks ago where we didn't record a show. So don't think you missed one. Essentially, Honky had to leave really early the next morning, and we usually tend to keep him up too late as it is. And I'd really just got home from the hospital an hour before the show would have started last week, and the one major issue that we had coming up had become moot that afternoon. We will talk about it here, but still important. It's still kind of hanging fire, but the correct decisions amazingly were made in its regard. I am your host this evening, 5150, back from the close to wishing I was dead for about a day, and also on the channel this evening we have Bookworm.
Greetings.
L. Minister.
Good evening, everyone.
Honky Magoo.
Evening.
Joe.
I am such a nerd.
And last but never least, Netminer. And I'll save it. But Joe, I heard you got outed on not the last tilts, but 2 weeks ago. Somebody saw you were moonlighting over here.
Yeah, it came up. Nobody seemed to mind.
And like I said, not least Netminer. I'm sorry. I should have talked to Joe about that before I got to you, and then looped around, and we never got to hear you say hello.
Well, I'm here along with the silent majority, Netminer too.
Yeah, Dan from Tilt seemed a little surprised that I actually talk about tech on this show.
Well, I mean, they haven't talked about anything technical on Tilts for years.
Yeah, it's very hit or miss on whether or not you're going to get tech on that show.
I'm amazed Dan listens. Thank you, Dan, if you're out there, and all our other faithful listeners. We would probably sit here and do the show whether anybody was listening or not, but it is definitely a bonus to know that some people are listening and are maybe even entertained, perhaps even edified.
Well, on this last Tilt show, they were talking about a different number of subscribers, and I was thinking he said that this show had like 2,000 subscribers or something.
No, it was about like 500.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah, which sounds about right for right now. When we first started off, we had our numbers from what we could tell from Blueberry Press, we actually hit up to close to about 1,000. But since then, it's just kind of slowly weaned down a little bit. But that's fine. Like 50 said, no matter what, I'd probably still be showing up here every first and third Friday.
Yeah, ever since I moved away from El Paso, I don't really have people that I just talk tech with, so I'd be here.
All right. We don't seem to have had any listener feedback in intervening about 4 weeks. I do believe the feedback email link is one that is working. Again, this is, I am not trying to criticize anybody about anything. I just want to clarify to folks what, you know, who are listening, what parts of the communications are working and what parts of the lines of communication are still broke. So, as usual, I'll let Honky address that again.
Well, the only thing that's not up right now is the mailing list. And again, that's just on me. I mean, going into, I went into the, I'm just going to sit here and make excuses. We went into the 4th of July week, and that just got to be really hectic for me. And then as soon as 4th of July was over, we went into me going on vacation for a week down in Florida, and then I got back, and then I still haven't had much chance to sit down. From what I can understand, I believe there are, free services that you can set up for mailing lists and stuff. So I don't know. I really got to look into it more because I think if I'm going to start in my initial Googling around, if I can't get anything off the bat, I believe Fweeb had talked about using different services for mailing lists when he had two mailing lists, I think, going between his two websites, between Monster Java Guns and Open Source Creative. I think both of those had their own mailing lists. So he had talked about those in the past. So I was gonna. I just haven't had a chance to sit down and look. But so the feedback is working. And actually, you posted something to the mailing list, and it got kicked around enough that it still got sent back to me, and I responded back to you. So it's still out there. But it basically just kicked around a bunch of errors and somehow made its way back to me. But the feedback is working. I got to set something up for a redirect. So when feedback comes to me, it will also go out to you, either that or I'm going to have to manually redirect for the time being. So, but we do have feedback. The site is up. All the feeds seem to be working fine. I haven't heard any problems about anything. We have in our show notes about the, there was a PDF that Kevin Wisher created a long time ago explaining how to connect to Mumble. I have not, before I redirected everything to the new site, I did a wget of the old site. And so I have all of the old site archived. And that was part of what got archived. What I want to do at some point in the near future is also make sure that gets put back onto the site because it's not right now. So that's where we stand.
Okay. Do we have any other general business before we head into show topics?
Well, I'm supposed to be talking about a certain tablet that I got working.
Okay, Joe, are you home yet, or did you want to wait till you got home before you talked about that?
Yeah, I think I'm going to wait till I get home to talk about it, so if you want to start doing your thing.
Okay, I just thought that might be easier on you where you're, still out and about. Okay, you guys probably don't see this right now, if you're listener listing, but old joke around this show, if you've been listening since the first year, is nobody asked 50 about his day ever, because he will tell you, and sometimes it will fall into an anecdote that some people didn't feel was appropriate for the show. Definitely this is going to fall outside the realm of open source, but I think it's important because most of us are getting to be gentlemen of a certain age where things don't always go particularly right. And where I'm headed with this, it would have been the Friday, a week after the last show, that was aired. And if you've listened to the show, and like I said, this is maybe new information for a lot of people listening, for a lot of people associated with the show, those who follow me on either Facebook or Google Plus have known about this the last couple weeks. But there are probably people here, people listening, this is the first they've heard of it. I spent a week in the hospital because I had blood clots in both lungs. Well, I shouldn't say had, still have. I thought I was having an episode of AFib. Regular listeners have probably heard me talk about that. Yeah, I've had some heart regulatory problems. I'm on medication that's supposed to control it. So, you know, but I couldn't feel my heart pounding, but everything else kind of fell into that. And, I mean, I wasn't in pain. It was like I could not put, you know, if somebody asked me what I'm experiencing, I could not put my finger on it. I could say, you know, I feel out of sorts. It seems like it's in the central body area. You know, and I've had minor ones that I let go on AFib that corrected themselves after a few minutes. You know, and I thought, well, I did this to myself. I had spent Thursday night before up all night messing around with computer stuff online until I looked outside. It was getting light. And I thought, well, you know, since right now, I'm not, you know, the farm workers being done by other folks, I share crop stuff out this year, not feeding cattle. I thought, well, you know, since I can set my own schedule, I thought, okay, I will, you know, spend the majority of the day napping. Laid down, could not get any sleep, just laying there and feeling weird. And, you know, it was like to do anything to get up would take all my concentration. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, because I'd been prescribed oxygen, not using it. But there was an oxygen bottle there in the house. I had a couple of them. Used one once before during an AFib attack that really didn't do much good. And had episodes sitting on the couch where all, you know, it's weird. Up and doing stuff, no problem. Sitting on the couch watching TV, I've had two or three things where it just didn't seem like I could get enough air. But, you know, after 15, 20 minutes, it would pass on its own. So I had never really gotten up to motivation to replace the oxygen bottle, which I thought, you know, try that. But we do have a thing in this county where if you call 911, they send an ambulance, there's no charge unless they take you to the hospital. You know, you just have them come out. And I thought, you know, oh, I probably should, you know, I don't feel like driving to the emergency room. You know, should I bother a friend? And then it got too late in the day to you know, wake somebody up to have them come out. So, finally, I had felt like laying there, you know, I felt really, really bad for a few minutes around probably 9 p.m. And, I was going to get on the phone and call. And then all of a sudden, it just started getting wet. You know, it was a lot better, a lot more relaxed. And, you know, started, I thought, being more clear-headed. So I thought, okay, I'll go take care of that oxygen thing and see if that helps. And, you know, it was all I could do to make it from the bedroom to the living room. Just had no energy at all. Got the outside door unlocked at least so they wouldn't have to kick it in. And said, okay, you know, I'm calling the ambulance. We're going to see about this. You know, so my whole moral on that is it was not AFib. Turns out when they got to me in the hospital, obviously they didn't think that's what it was. Put me in the, not the MRI, the thing starts with C.
CAT
scan, yes. put me in the CAT scan. Well, they did x-rays, put me in the CAT scan, did all kinds of other tests, did a whole bunch of blood tests. And then finally they came back and, you know, I could see that the nurse who had done the x-ray told the other nurse there what it was, but it was too low for me to hear. And I said, well, I heard her tell you, what is it? And she said, no, I don't know what it is. We got to wait, you know, got to wait for the RA to come, you know, or PA to come in, you know. In other words, telling you was above her, telling me was above her pay grade, even though she knew what it was. Bureaucracy is a wonderful thing. But he did come in and said, no, what you have is you've got a blood clot on both lungs, and, you know, so the oxygen is not getting into your blood, and this is why you are feeling the way you are feeling, and I guess, you know, you would think no more than what the treatment was. You'd think they could do that at the local hospital, but no, they sent me to the big heart hospital. Probably a liability thing, but, you know. And for about a week, they pushed IV blood thinners into me. It was pretty much the treatment. Now, that does not break up the blood clots in the lungs. Time is the only thing that's going to do that. You know, but the blood thinners were to keep me from, you know, having any more blood clots down in my legs that would move up. I mean, they assumed that's where they were. They never did find any in my legs. They did like the whole sonogram thing. They tried to do that the first day, and when they laid me flat, I felt nauseous, which I don't know. I think it's probably because all that Friday then I didn't eat either, you know, because I didn't feel like getting up and eating anything. And sometimes that will, you know, next day, if I don't eat at all, then the next day I, you know, I don't want to start with a big, heavy meal. You start with something simple. And they had given me like a fruit insert thing or something. you know, not trying to be too blunt, but they laid me down flat and that all came back. So they said, no, we can't do it. And the next morning I felt fine. And they were able to come in and do that. But by that time, you know, the blood thinners, I guess, had got rid of all the clots anywhere but in my lungs. You know, they checked the heart, they checked the legs, and since they always assume it's in the legs. And again, if you've listened to the show before, you know, back in 2016, I had a problem. I'm sure I talked about it here probably. You know, I felt real bad pain around the backside, you know, around my middle section. And again, it was similar to something I had before, felt similar. I sat there and self-diagnosed, and I think, well, it's diverticulitis. I've had that before, and it went away. Apparently, I didn't know. Sometimes they got to do surgery and take out a chunk of your colon to get rid of that. And so it's more serious than I was led to believe at the time. But That's where like a seed or something gets in like a flap in your colon and irritates it. But mine had passed, you know, this is going way back, but mine had passed on or was passing on just as, you know, as I showed up at the doctor's office. And like the blood clot in my kidney last year, that was dissolving. I mean, if they'd done the CAT scan 30 minutes later, they wouldn't have found it. But I'm sure they probably already, by then they had a pretty good idea what it was. And this time they knew what it was. And I am feeling so much better in the last 3 weeks, but, you know, I'm still not back 100%. They've still, that noise that you may hear in the background sounds like a compressor is the, oxygen condenser running here in the same room. And I am on this big long tube that lets me go pretty much all around the house, and it's not like if I take the thing off that on, you know, I fall down on my face immediately. But I was kind of surprised once I came, you know, I was in the heart hospital for a week. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, and my whole point is, like I said, a lot of us here and a lot of us listening are folks of a certain age, and. You know, if there's a point to my story is, you know, don't self-diagnose. Don't sit there and think, well, you know, since I can't identify what this is, it's, you know, because I can't tell them I'm in pain or I'm, you know, or this or that, that it's not something serious, you know. So, I was in a bad way, and I tried to sit there and let it pass for far too long before I got on the phone and called for help. And just don't do that. That kind of stupidity will kill you. Okay, so like I said, the treatment was pretty much put me in bed, don't let me move, poke holes all over me, and pump blood thinners into me intravenously for about a week. And you know, I got progressively better, got where, you know, they put me on a long enough hose that I could actually get up, go to the restroom. They didn't let me do that for a couple days. They had the more embarrassing options that had to be done on a shorter tether. But sorry if that offends anybody. But you know, it got more and more autonomous. But they would. They'd get the same hospital I went to for the AFib. You know, before they let you go, they wouldn't want you, you know, make so many circuits up and down the hallway. And the thing was, even on a cart carrying the oxygen, I felt that. Well, even getting up and using the facilities, I could feel that too. And I thought, yeah, I'm going to get home and I'm just going to be laying around all day. And there was quite a bit of argument letting me loose a week later. You know, to the day a week later, you know, one department saying, you know, at the oxygen, because they were still, I was at 6 liters of oxygen, and I do have the concentrator, or had a concentrator in front of my BiPAP machine, so I already had a concentrator at home, but it only went to 5, so it's like Spinal Tap situation. I needed one that went to 11, or at least 10. You know, so they had me on going home on 6 to 8. So my home health people had to run home, and my cousin was able to let him in the house, and you know, left a bunch of oxygen and a bit and a more powerful accumulator, or not accumulator, condenser, because that was the only way the hospital would let me go if I had that at home. And the middle road might have been send me to like a rest home sort of thing. For a few days until I got where I could turn the oxygen down some. But, you know, they've been saying, yeah, we want to wean you off this oxygen. In fact, having too high of oxygen, Jason, in your blood is a bad thing. I didn't know. Well, one of the nurses said, yeah, when I went through nursing, and she was young, so when I went through nursing school, it was like, you get oxygen, and you get oxygen, and you get oxygen. And, you know, since then we've learned too high gives people cancer and heart disease and all kinds of bad things. So they don't want you like 98-99% oxygen. They're a lot happier if you're in the mid to low 90 percentile. And I've got one of those things, goes on my finger, had that. Shows oxygenation in my blood, you know, cheap Walmart. Well, I don't know about cheap. Probably the more expensive of the ones Walmart sells, but when I see the home health care people show up with the same one, I figure I probably got, you know, it's probably not such, it's not a junk piece of junk at least. So, and you know, like right now, I've had things, in the past day, I'm not supposed to sleep without the BiPAP, but sometimes you get tired watching TV or whatever, fall asleep, and you know, like last night, the thing came out of my nose for a while, and so when I woke up, it'd probably been without being on oxygen for some time, but you know, I tested my oxygenation, and it was, you know, it was still 46, so I think right now, I'm going to wait till doctor tells me that I don't need the oxygen, but, you know, I think right now most of the time I could get by, though. Like I said, I went to town today and it was pushing 100, and yeah, I, you know, couple short stops, I jumped out, left oxygen in the truck, and I could tell, I felt it a little bit. You know, getting back on oxygen definitely made a difference. So I am not quite ready to be off of it completely in every situation. I may never be, but I think I am getting back to the point where you know I don't have to have it all the time. I am to the point this last week. I talked to my heart, well, I guess not heart doctor, lung doctor, whatever. Well, maybe it is heart doctor. They keep asking me if I have a pulmonologist, and surprised that I don't. I have a sleep doctor, I had a heart doctor, didn't have a pulmonologist. Well, probably do through the heart hospital now, but not the main doctor on all this. But where was I going with this? I'm down to the point where I could, the insurance company will pay for part of it, you know, carry around one of these satchel mobile accumulators so I'm not pushing the oxygen cart with me every place I go when I get outside the house. That will be definitely something, and it would be a thing. You know, especially if I didn't have to have it all the time, just on a, 100-degree day out building fence or something like that, if I had to grab that thing. Even if that was from now on, that wouldn't be so bad if it wasn't like I have to have that in, every time I leave the house. That would get to be biting. Especially, they won't let you get on an aircraft with an oxygen bottle. So the mobile accumulator would be a much better... or mobile concentrator would be a much better thing. They have some, I've been looking at things, if in that, eventuality that I can never wean myself completely off oxygen, what my options are. And they are semi-mobile ones that you can mount in a vehicle, if you guys... most of you guys probably don't know my latest that I thought at the time was a ridiculous purchase. A couple weeks before all this, I made the purchase of a 1984 Cadillac hearse, and actually, right now that's looking like the perfect road trip vehicle if I'm going to have to be carrying around a whole bunch of oxygen bottles and other medical accoutrement. So I'll pause if there's any comments, questions so far.
Yeah, I actually spent some time Monday, Tuesday on oxygen monitoring, as well as being wired for everything but stereo. And I have my own cute story about that while we're doing medical tech. When it's my turn.
Okay, we just call this the old man medical show.
The old man medical show. 50, I'm sorry to interrupt, man, but it sounds like you had a lot of acute issues. If you don't mind me asking, do they have you on any form of blood thinners?
Yeah, they've got me on Zoltro right now. I was getting to that. So when they sent me home, I'm now going to be on blood thinners the rest of my life. Now I had been on blood thinners, and my personal physician or general physician, he was of the opinion that blood clots were caused because I've got some cartilage damage to my knees. Have been there, since my late 20s. It's just been getting worse and worse, and I've gone to progressively more supportive knee braces, and those are the type of only, they only really meant to be used for sports, not meant to be used worn, every waking hour, like I was doing it. So, and that does cut off circulation, and that's what the doctor thought had been causing probably caused the blood clots. So after he got me to leave those off for about a year, you know, and blood clots didn't, you know, no sign of any more blood clots, he said, oh, yeah, we can probably drop the blood thinner because it caught, you know, Pradaxa is going to start to cost money. That first year of Pradaxa, it's like a street drug. They give you a card and say, hey, first year's free. And then
you go right, first year's free. First year's free. No, I'm sorry. I'm keep going.
And but then after that, all of a sudden, you know, you go in and you get your meds and it's gone from $30 to $150, you know, a month when you go in. And what's that? Oh, yeah, your product, you know, that first year free Pradax is done. But, you know, they said they wanted me on Zolotro when I came home. I said, don't worry about it. It's cheap. Got home, next day, went in to fill the prescription, and I had some friends drive me in that day. I said, you know, no, first week I'm home, I am not even going to try to drive. And went in there, and they said, first, we don't have enough to fill that script, and what we've got to fill is going to be $1,200. And I said, and they were saying, are you sure you want us to fill that? And I said, well, I've got half a bottle of Pradaxa and that much more of warfarin at home. Surely we can, you know, get them to change the script. And this was Saturday, and left a message for the doctor's nurse saying, hey, you know, the Zaltro thing's not going to work. And got a very, very sort of angry phone call back first thing Monday morning. Says, no, you've got to be on Zaltro for the first month or whatever. But they were cool. They said, you know, we've got all these samples. We're going to send them to you, but it's going to take 3 days for them to get to you. So you got to go in and get six pills. And those six pills are like $90.
Holy shit, man. Pardon my French there, but that's a lot of freaking money, bro. The reason why I asked you about blood thinners, though, because you mentioned you're on oxygen and stuff like that. And I know some blood thinners out there, they affect your hemoglobin count, you know, but they do have selective blood thinners out there that target specific the hemoglobin is divided into four separate subcategories. And they do have specific medications that target each subcategory to raise your hemoglobin count or keep it from below a certain amount and still help you out to, you know, not get all those blood clots you've been getting a lot lately. Have you talked to your doctor about that yet?
Well, see, my GP was on, as it happened, was on vacation all this week. So, and he was booked up the week before. So I'm going to see him on Monday. So maybe he can explain the ins and outs of this. But like I said, they sent me the Zaltro. And so, you know, I've got about 10 tiny little bottles of about six pills in each one. No, it was more than that. But, you know, enough to get me by to this time where they said, you know, after that you can go on Pradaxa, which is not inexpensive, but it's not $1,200 a month.
Holy smokes, man. I would suggest I'm not a doctor. Just talk to your doctor, man, and say, look, the blood thinners, from what you've been telling us right now, I can see that the blood thinners is what's affecting your hemoglobin count, and that's what's causing you to need all this oxygen most of the time. And then you have the blood clots happening all the time. So you have to target down what kind of blood thinners they're giving you that don't affect those two symptoms you've been getting, you know, not to drop your hemoglobin count and not to affect your blood into clotting up in areas you don't want it to clot up. You know what I'm saying? So stop worrying about the price, man. It's your health. It's your life, man. We need more techies around. So talk to your doctor about that, man.
Oh, definitely I will. And in August, I'll be seeing the heart doctor again. So early August. So, you know, between the two of them, we'll get it all figured out. You're right. I mean, if it was that or dying, yeah, I could swing it. But I could think of other things. If it's optional, I would rather spend $1,200 a month on. But yeah, we'll have to look into options. I mean, I've seen all those ads. It's weird. You're laying there in the hospital, and it seems like two out of three ads are aimed at old people with all kinds of problems. Maybe that's, and I don't think they're inserting their own ads. It's just, that's the way all the stuff on basic cable, that's who they target. But, Zoltro ad said, oh yeah, the Pradaxa, it affects these five systems and the Zoltro, we just target the one. So I guess there's definitely a difference, but, we'll have to see where that's going. The other thing that's been done, most of you guys probably don't know that I may have mentioned on the show, I've been living too much like a bachelor, and my house has got to be where it was like a
welcome to the club of bachelors.
Thank you. My house has got to be where it was looking too much like a bad episode of Hoarders. I'd done stuff like, run the dishwasher, and then instead of putting all the dishes away, use dishes out of the dishwasher, and then sinks got full of dishes, and got to the point, and I've done this before and swore I'd never get back to it again, where, I would wash one dish, and utensils, fix one meal, with whatever, wash whatever dishes I had needed to fix the next meal, and actually washing those in the bathroom because the dishes were all full, the sink was all full up. So I'd been doing that for a while, and I really thought I was going to be laid out a lot more when I got out of the hospital, because like I said, they were running me back and forth, and just even getting up, going to the restroom, I'd be sitting there on the edge of the bed, getting my breath back, and really have not had that since getting home at all. I mean, pretty much, after the first couple of days, I've been able to do, as long as I'm on the oxygen, anything that I've ever have been able to do. And like I said, now it's get to the point where, and until I walk outside and it's 110 degrees in the shade, I'm feeling like, oh, I don't need the oxygen. But like I said, I'm going to have the doctors tell me that before I experiment too much on my own. Okay, so called some people up, had to call around, finally got some people who are interested in coming out and taking the contract to get the house cleaned up. And they were kind of intermittent, but finally between them and I and the last few days that I'd been a full participant, got all the junk out of the house, got all the dishes cleaned, got the countertops all cleaned up and the sinks and all that, got floors cleaned, and there are a whole bunch of things. Like I would get a box of something in and, get the stuff out and leave the box laying there. Or, if it was something I got, oh, this is a good price on that, and I'll need that eventually, it's, maybe still be sitting in the box a year later. So, went through. I mean, there was stuff, well, I knew where it was. It wasn't like it was lost. I was very few things surprised. So I did come across yesterday two Chromecasts that I didn't know I had. And since I've got a Chromecast on every TV, I gave them to the ladies who came to help me out. I said, you guys want these? Because I'm not looking to buy any more TVs very soon. So made them happy.
Good man. Good man. Good man. Stay away from the TVs. Those things are evil, bro.
But, I'm the guy that has one in every pretty much every room because they're so cheap. One One in the dining room, one in the living room, which there's no partition between, so it's essentially two ends of the same room. One in the kitchen, which really isn't partitioned. So, you know, if I have to face the other wall for some reason, I can still watch the TV. My back won't be to the TV. One in the bathroom, which I really do use. I run the news report every day when I'm in there. And then one in the safe room, so I can, you know, I can bring up the local weather if I have to go in there and hide from tornadoes. And one in the garage, so I can't use that as an excuse not to work on, you know, not to fix stuff. Well, I'd like to go fix my truck, but, you know, I want to watch Netflix this evening. So, no, I can't use that as an excuse. So it's just because I've been, over the last couple of years, I've been picking them up slow by, hitting Walmart on Black Friday or whatever and getting the really cheap TVs that they got. But, but you're right. I spend too much time watching stuff on streaming video. Okay, but to get on with that, what else? A couple more things I wanted to cover. Like I said, got the house cleaned up these last couple weeks. Big accomplishment. You know, it's nice actually being able to get dishes out of the cabinet and use it, not having to jump over things when I'm walking around the house. you know, having counter space to use, being able to, you know, not saying, well, I'd like to cook that, but I can't because, you know, I'd have to spend too much time cleaning dishes to cook that. So, things have been a lot better the last few days. Now it's stuff has been sorted out. Honky and the rest of the regulars on the show will be glad to know I haven't got it going yet. I was hoping to, but haven't had time. But I have got the Pico C brewing machine out of the box, which is partially powered, we know, by Linux, and sitting on the counter and looking at the instructions. And I think it's really cool. Something like that first instruction is, turn it on and connect it to your Wi-Fi. Usually that may be a bad sign for appliances, but for something like this, I think, you know, probably getting updates and whatever is not a bad idea. Especially if it enhances, you know, if they can fix bugs or, you know, enhance capabilities that way. So I'm looking forward to doing that. Set the bread maker that I got used 2 years ago up on her, at least more than a year, up on the counter. So I'm going to clean it up and see if I can if it still works and makes bread. Otherwise, I may just do it the old-fashioned way in the oven. Other than that, like I said, since I got down on lower oxygen level, talked to the heart doctor's nurse this week and said, hey, can I get one of those mobile, we'll say accumulator, but, you know, the thing pulls the oxygen out of the air, condenser. And said, yeah, you know, you're down to the level where you could get one of those now. So called the medical supply place and said, yeah, so they take care of the paperwork. They couldn't get it in a day. But the other thing that I've been having trouble with lately, I've been going a couple of weeks on this thing at home and not really had any problem. And just the last few days, terrible sinus congestion, you know, and it's not much point if you got this thing pushing oxygen up your nose when you can't breathe through your nose. And the nurse said, yeah, get some of the saline nasal spray, which I think is just like a generic Afrin, you know, maybe not whatever chemicals they add in there, but just a saline spray. And that, you know, that opens your nose up. So, yeah, because antihistamines hadn't done any good. I've been trying wasabi on a cracker, which does okay for a few minutes and then it goes back. So, but the thing was, I was talking
With the what the saline spray does is that it does, it just removes airborne allergens from your nasal passages and gives it a moment to your sinuses, gives them time to swell down, I guess you would call it. But it doesn't get rid of bloodborne allergens. So maybe diet, you might be want to look into what might be causing into your allergies to swell up your allergies.
Maybe. I don't know if I, as far as I know, I'm not allergic to any kind of foods. So, and, you know, this has just been the last few days, so I can't imagine what would have changed in the last few days. But thanks. I'll consider that.
How recently did you have the house cleaned?
Well, yeah, that's part of it too. The different cleaners and chemicals, well, that, and getting the dust in the air. That I'm sure that had an effect on it too.
Yeah, dust absolutely kills me. Anytime I start cleaning the house or working around stuff like that, it nearly lays me out. It's that bad sometimes.
Yeah, I think you're probably on the right track. But the one thing, you know, the nurse told me, well, you can add a humidifier into the line, which is essentially just a bottle full of, I've got reverse osmosis to take salt out of the water, so I'm in a fairly salty area, even when they don't drill directly into the salt dome like they did when the house was originally constructed. But, there's still a lot of chemicals in salt. You know, I thought, well, got high blood pressure. I don't need additional salt being added by the water. So, put reverse osmosis filters in at the sinks and in the bathrooms, you know. And so I can get clean water to put in the thing. And it's just a plastic jar, and the air coming out of the thing bubbles through it. And actually, the nurse was surprised that they hadn't included that, you know, by default. And I talked to the healthcare supplier. Said, no, you know, it's really not a big deal, but that's not our default loadout. So. Went into town today, got one of those, filled up with water, the line, and man, I just noticed an immediate difference. And I was surprised. They had me on that at the hospital, but I don't know. The design of what they had in the hospital was probably too much, because my nose was just constantly dripping from the moisture and the oxygen. And it's not doing that. It's just perfect. It's just enough that I can feel, wow, that is suddenly a lot more comfortable, a lot less irritating, but without, you know, having to constantly wipe my nose like I was at the hospital. So just the perfect situation. So that's another thing I want to throw out there. If you're ever stuck on this whole home oxygen deal with condenser, and they bring that to your house, or you get it, you know, you get it or whatever, ask them about the humidifier. If it doesn't come with the humidifier, ask them about it, because they'll, you know, it's probably something they'll just give you. It's not a big deal to them. I'm guessing. I mean, it was like, yeah, come by and get it. You know, we don't put it on by default, but it's not like a big deal. It's like, well, it's not a big, you know, I'm thinking, if it wasn't a big deal, I mean, it's a plastic bottle. I'm sure it's probably a $50 plastic bottle, but, you know, it's a plastic bottle with a tube going through it. So that may be my, you know, I think that's probably my last comment. You know, if you will thank yourself if you're on this condenser, you'll thank yourself if you get one of those put in the line.
Those are all good health tips to chew on, man.
Well, thanks. I mean, I just thought, you know, nothing at all to do with Linux, but like I said, I'm sure there's people in the audience that if they don't benefit from now, you know, might benefit from the advice someday. My main thing is, you know, if you're sitting there and you feel it all funky and you just cannot get up and accomplish anything, that's probably bad enough to call a friend and get, you know, or a relative or whatever, and get yourself into the hospital and have it checked out, or get the ambulance if not, you know. If I'd known for sure it wasn't something the ambulance people couldn't take care of and leave, I would have probably got some, you know, friend to take me in earlier in the day. But, you know, it's the good part is between now and the end of the year, my deductible is taken care of for sure.
I'm over here laughing about your deductibles, man. Like, well, insurance is not cheap.
Well, it was like my symptoms were my legs just wouldn't hold me up. Just went down, waited a minute, got up, walked a couple yards, went down again, and my body was just not having it. Sorry, Charlie. And at that point, I accepted the help of... This is Park Street in Boston. I accepted the help of the MBTA and the EMTs and then the ambulance people. And they got me around to the University Medical Center, and, you know, they got me some oxygen and got me IVs and whatnot. You know, I got a chest x-ray and a whole bunch of stuff. But the funny thing was, early on, my vitals were pretty shitty. So they limited the amount of water that they gave me. Later on, when my vitals came back after rest and oxygen and whatnot, they said, all right, we'll check you out. We'll check your fluids. We'll check everything. And when they actually admitted me in the hospital from the emergency room, they said, sure, you can drink, you can eat whatever you want. Well, when I get up to the room, everybody's saying, well, the order hasn't come through, the order hasn't come through, the order hasn't come through. So about 11 o'clock, I go to sleep. Well, the nurse comes in to tell me that I can now drink. I'm in for dehydration, by the way. But she sees that I'm asleep, so I don't get the order. And the patient technician, what we might call in the old days an orderly, wasn't given a word. So nobody really allowed. I heard about the order that I could drink about 6:15 in the morning. And most of the water that I had, was out of 3 half-liter bottles that I was carrying for my trip to Boston. So I wasn't using their water much of the time.
Netminer, are you in the shower right now?
Nope. If there's a background noise, I'll shut down my fans, but that's probably it.
Oh, we don't have any trouble understanding you, so, you know, keep doing whatever makes you comfortable.
Just to join the misery needs company crowd, I'm also one of those people of a certain age, be 50, in fact, at the end of the year. And I just, about 6 weeks ago, started on blood pressure medication for the first time in my life. And I find that my migraine headaches have reduced by about 60% since I went on the blood pressure medicine. You know, I still get them occasionally, but not with nearly the frequency I was. So I guess my major symptom of the higher elevated blood pressure was constant headaches.
Yeah, I could see how that could probably cause, you know, a headache. Mom always got that. I don't know if they were... Well, surely they tested her for high blood pressure or whatever, but she not migraines necessarily, but just, you know, almost to that level, and suffered those, you know, probably at least once a week later years of her life. But
blood pressure is a pretty common thing for him to check for. I was going to my migraine specialist, and he's like, "Your blood pressure's high." I'm like, "Yeah, I know." And this went on for like 2 years. And eventually I went to my regular GP for a checkup, and he's like, "Let's get you on something about that blood pressure."
And, that was one of the things. And, of course, you always tell them you're drinking less beer and what you are. But I said, you know, they want me to drink less beer because they say, you're floating all your minerals right out of your bloodstream. You know, they've got me on potassium right now. And, but actually they've cut me off most of the blood pressure medication that I was on. They said, "No, your blood, you know, you're in the hospital and your blood pressure was just fine, you know, without the medication." So we said, "We don't want to get it too low." So, you know, a couple things that the GP had me on, they've got me cut out. And, you know, home health keeps coming. You know, I did get on sort of with home health. You know, they won't, Blue Cross would not pay for the full package of home health, and that's where they come out and wash your dishes and stuff and clean your house, which, you know, no, I don't need that. I mean, a lot of this stuff that the home health, obviously the exercises they have you do are for people who, you know, nearly can't stand on their own. You know, that if you sit, you know, they get up from the bed, they go sit in a chair and they watch TV, and that's about all they're capable of doing in a day, and they're not capable of getting up and fixing a meal or whatever. And you could see that. I don't, you know, they gave me all the rubber band things. If you guys ever had a relative who had to do that, and I'm sure Netminer's probably seen these. You know, wrap this thing around your legs, and you do the little, you know, all these little exercises. Like, yeah, I can literally do this all day. And I am not in great shape by any means, but it's like, you know, I've been kind of like, what else you got? You know, and they finally came out, okay, here's the big nasty black rubber band, beat this. And, you know, really, okay. Okay, wow, yeah, I can feel that now. So if nothing else, probably some of these exercises that they're doing is probably going to be a help, with my knees. I have noticed, I kind of almost forgot where I had everything in the shelves, so I let the ladies repack the shelves, and I actually built, you know, showing I'm not in huge bad condition. I ordered a couple shelves for, you know, freestanding cabinets from Walmart and built them in a couple nights. Because I was getting to where, you know, I didn't have enough storage for both dishes and food whenever that, you know, so I figure if I can do, if I can assemble cabinets, you know, and especially these big boxes, that was about all I could do to bring it. Well, the first set of boxes, UPS guy brought them in. Second set, UPS guy takes off, you know, and probably normally I could pick them up, drag them in. Fairly heavy. And I said, no, I am going to get the hand cart. And I got the hand cart, strapped them on, brought them in. Because, you know, I was like, you know, trying to be Mr. Manly, you were going to screw up and fall over in front of all these nice ladies who are helping you with the house, and you're going to feel really silly. So I brought those in. But yeah, at night I was able to open up those boxes, separate out the parts, and, you know, assemble cabinets and put them together and drag them into place. So I don't think I'm in huge trouble right now. I mean, it was an effort, but not beyond my capabilities. But like today, you know, where they put the dishes, you know, and places where I might have broke stuff up, you know, in the two or three places, all these glass bowls that fit together like Russian dolls, they had them all together, and to get one out, you pretty much had to up on the top shelf, lift the whole thing down, and it's like, okay, that's fine for now. In 10, 15, 20 years, that is going to be a problem for me. I could tell that looking at it. So, you know, there's always going to be stuff, make adjustments for declining capabilities. I mean, I am at the point where I can see that from here. And like I said, did not want to make the whole show about our own various disabilities, but
don't get me started on mine.
Like I said, these are just observations, things to think about going forward, or things that I'm going to have to think about going forward. So, like I said, that's probably most of the health stuff. Netminder, you kind of went over yours. Was there anything you wanted to add?
Well, I had a doctor's appointment today. It was made by the hospital, but the hospital, maybe it's in my paperwork, but they didn't inform me that I had a doctor's appointment today. It's been one of them weeks.
I know what you mean. In fact, I was lucky they called, because I have been under the impression all week that my doctor's appointment with my GP was Tuesday. And, of course, probably I would have looked over the weekend at my calendar. But, they had the reminder call and the reminder email told me, no, it's Monday. Oh, okay. You know, I'm glad they didn't do that. They didn't used to. You know, you had to find the little white card, you know, if you didn't put it down anywhere.
Not to switch gears here abruptly here, guys. I know we've been talking a lot of good healthy stuff, you know, and getting some good tips and whatnots and what not to do. But recently I've been fiddling around with the NH8 3D printer. And do any of you guys know anything about this kind of stuff?
A little bit.
Recently, I started printing on the Anet some of their test files they have there. And I noticed that the end product comes out a little bit flaky around the edges. You guys know anything that might be causing that? Is it the tightness of the bolt or a problem with the G-code?
Sounds more like a general adjustment problem rather than the G-code. Probably if you look for forms for that printer. And one podcast in particular, if you go to podnuts.com, and that's podnetz.com, and look for the Maker's Show. And again, that's Makers with a Z. If you want to learn this stuff, they broadcast, I guess, it's Wednesday nights that they do the show. As long as you can come through with clear audio, and you see it sound fairly clear to me, they also get together. Well, no, they used to over Mumble. Not sure what they're using right now. But, you could probably join in with them, or certainly, you know, address questions to them through email, because that's pretty much what they do. They do the makery sort of thing. I've got a 3D printer, but it's one of those really cheap Hero 101s. And after assembling it, I kept hearing worse and worse stuff about it. Never had I'll get back to it now. That's one of the things that maybe having spent a little more time at home and stuff, and having the house cleared out where I'm not jumping across things to get to other things, I will be able to get back to more of my Maker's projects. And, you know, but after getting the 101 and assembling it and looking into it, there were a lot of things like, you know, am I wasting my time with this silly thing? Should I just go spend a little more money? You know, well, when I bought it, there probably weren't any good 3D printers under $300. Now there's several decent under $150, but it's like,
yeah, the Ennett A8s I have is actually pretty freaking cheap, but I keep hearing good reviews about it, you know, and some of the sample printouts that they sent me were pretty nice, very nice. So I'm wondering, there's a lot of stuff I've been teaching myself on this. I had to get the Fusion 360 development kit for it, which was actually free. If you click on the enthusiasts account, whatnot, otherwise it would have cost me upwards of $1,000, which I don't have that money to spend. And then I'm trying to merge that with the Cure Ultimaker, the software that the Anet came with, and I'm still trying to figure out how to center that on the actual flatbed of the 3D printer, because every time I develop something, I design something on the Fusion 360 and I export it to the Cure software, it starts printing on a wrong corner of the flatbed. It doesn't center it completely. But it's what my problem is that, will the A-Nets still keep fleshing out flaky? Because it's like when I created one, this one test file, just a simple box, and the end product, it comes out, it's supposed to be sturdy, but when you squeeze a little bit, it doesn't take much to squeeze on it, and it bends, it kind of like caves in on itself, almost like a rubber instead of a hard plastic as I was expecting it to be, and I rub my finger up and down along the sides of it and it comes out flaky, and that's my issue right now.
All right, so two things. One, the was this a test thing that you created on your own, or was this a test thing that like came with the printer?
No, it was a test. It was a test file that came with the printer. It came out also with this cute little Baymax, which I ran out of filament with the filament it came with. I had to get some extra filament from Paul, which he's not here right now. But it went, when I printed out that little doll, the Baymax, it was a bit sturdier because it had a filler in it. I guess it does this little matrix inside for you to save more filament, I guess. But I printed out a couple of the test files that have it. It had one of a little, I'm sorry, excuse me, I've been drinking all night. It came out with a little box and a little brush, a pencil brush container, like a little barrel on the side, and I was under the impression that those little things would be a lot sturdier than I thought they would be.
So, like you were talking about before, the it should, which I'm surprised that it came with a the G code for something like that, but it should be what's you're talking about, the filler, which is when it has that little honeycomb inside. That's what makes it sturdy. And a lot of times,
correct.
Right, and then when you bring it into something like Cura, you can usually tell it what's the, like the, is that they're called the infill. I think that you change the style of what the infill is. It changes from like the honeycomb to like hexagon. You can change it to like 20%
on
infill.
Cura. On Cura, I can, with the program it came with, I can import those files and change around the type of filler it has and everything. But every time I save the file and I try to reprint, it doesn't center on the platform anymore. And I've been looking around, I've been training myself, and it looks like I haven't set the personal printer settings on that file. So I just have to center the XY in the code that I'm going to have to get Note++ eventually, but I know where I have to go to get it to center. It's the the filament itself, it prints out when I test the G code before I don't even have to put it into Kira. It came in the little SD card with the package I got, and you just pop the SD card in and tell the printer, after you do all your settings and adjustments and everything, to start printing. You know, it's basically plug and go after you build it, after 4 or 5 hour hard work of that. But once it started printing, it has these little burrs on. I know I have a little burrs on the brush barrel. It's kind of like a pencil holder, basically. And when I run my thumbs up and down on the side of it, it flakes. It flakes. What, and that's what's getting me right now.
What's the temp that you're printing at?
The recommended temp for this PLA is 210 on the extruder. And the hot bed is 70 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right. I don't know about the bed plate because mine don't have a bed plate. But I'd say the experiment. It's not a. I don't think it's a bed. It's a belt thing. And look, I'm not the authority on this. I got a Trunks EX1, which I've been playing around with, that I got, you know, every once in a while I'll get it going really good, and then other times I got, like right now, I haven't had a chance to sit down and try to fix it again, but right now it's not working at all. But I think when I ran into, because I ran into belts, the belt tension issues, with the belt tension issue, I found that it would start printing fine, like the first several layers, and then as it went up, it just, everything started to shift like over. And that they, I joined a, like, I'm not a big Facebook guy. I joined just so I can, like, occasionally keep track of family, but there's a Trunksy Facebook group. And when I asked any questions on that Facebook group, they are like fast, really fast at responding, and with really good information and some like good questions and some good information. There might be some ANET 8 groups. I know the ANET 8 is, definitely been one of the more popular printers for people who just want to get started with 3D printing, because how cheap it is to buy, and it's, you know, it's a pretty general setup. So, you know, even if once you get printing with it, you can like print some add-ons and stuff like that to make it like an even better printer. But I just did some quick looking, and from what I've seen in the quick looking, some of that, the flakiness on the outside may be due to, just play around with your speed and temperature. I think that might have something more to do with it. And the other part just does seem to be like the infill. I would try to go to Thingiverse, find yourself, I know they have the, try to find they have a like test cube that has like the X, Y, and Z on the little cube itself. Bring that into Cura. Play with like with the different infill. I think 20% infill is usually standard for things. And then by the sounds of it, you need to figure out where the center is. I'm kind of surprised that the ANET 8 isn't one of the default printers in Cura.
Yeah, I had to manually import it and start messing around with the settings on that. That's what kind of ticked me off about the Cura it came with. Then I'm like, wait, if it comes with this program, why do I have to find out all the specs and recommended settings for the ANET 8 to type in manually? And this is why I have to get NET++, so I can just start messing with the code and reset those settings. That I'm not worried about. It's just what I don't want to do is just have to chase down all those recommended settings and find the specific temperature I need. I know the recommended ones is 210, you know, between 200 and 210 for the extruder temperature. And the heating bed is between 60 and 75. It just is kind of irking me right now, having to chase down all this information. You know,
Now, one of the things you're going to have to realize when buying a cheaper 3D printer, and this is something that I had to realize too, they're not giving you the specifics for anything. They basically gave you the machine, everything basically to build the machine, and a lot of times from what I've seen online and whatnot, if you have all of, if in the box that you got in for the 3D printer, you got in all of the working parts, you won. If everything that works out of the box, you won. But don't expect that anything directly out of the box is going to work, and that anything that they gave you is going to work right. You know, it's. So they gave you Cura. They basically said, here's a tool. Here's a box of motors and stuff. When you put it all together with these very vague instructions, then it'll...
Right. It's just, they're like, here's something that's plug and play. We expect you to know everything.
The words...
You know, how to run this.
The words kit... should be a dead giveaway that this is not something that you're going to pull out of the box and with everything that they gave you be just printing right off the bat and everything is going to work properly. You're going to have
some of those test files print pretty fine. Like that little Baymax figurine I printed out. I actually have it on my bookshelf right now. I'm looking at it. It's pretty fine, but it's... I guess I'm going to have to look into this a bit more and learn the quirks of this, ain't it? I'm not giving up on this. I have a lot of projects that I've been meaning to get out there, and this is what I invested in, I guess. So this is what I'm going to have to refine, kind of like a building my own katana sword, old style, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well,
YouTube is your friend. Google is your friend. I'm sure there's, like I said, the Anet 8 is one of the more popular of the cheap learning 3D printers. So I'm sure there's lots of things out there. When it comes to centering the bed with Cura, there is a specific G code that will start it off at that specific point. In Cura, what you can do is you can set it up so the beginning of the G code is where it'll start up there. One thing I'm going to have to learn how to do is when the thing is done to pull its the bring the head all the way back and bring the head all the way up and over. Right now, it just kind of pulls itself away from the bed, which is fine, but I'd prefer if it actually like went up so I can have better access to the build plate. It's one of those things, once you can find out what that those specific instructions are in Cura, you can add it so that every time that you print, it's at the beginning or at the end of the G code it spits out.
By the way, I am home now.
And what I've learned from listening to the Maker shows is, you know, even the guys who have some experience, sometimes on a particular print, they've got to, you know, they have to chase it down. I mean, and like Conky said, play with the heat settings, play with the speed settings. You know, that not to expect you download something from Thingiverse, plug it in, and the first time you're going to get something usable or good. You know, you're going to have to look at it, and you know, just the process of experience. Okay, this, you know, I need to adjust it this way, or I need to adjust it that way. The other thing being the drawback of, you know, the cheaper printers, the ones that are sub $1,000 even, you know, kits, you know, I mean, $1,000 kits. It is the quality of the parts. Are you're getting what you pay for? So most of the people get these say, well, yeah, we get them, but you know, we've learned that we have to upgrade the stepper motors over time, or upgrade the extruder, upgrade this, upgrade that, and by the time you're done, you've got practically a new printer and then a pile of parts of what used to be your old printer. I mean, you could almost, you know, by the time you're done,
I already see that happening with me. But Oh God, I forgot where I was. I'm sorry about 50. Continue.
No, that was exactly my point. I mean, just that, you know, most of these people say, you know, if you start on that lower end printer, you are going to wind up with a good printer and a pile of parts that used to be your old printer.
And be prepared to learn a lot.
Oh, that's the only thing I love about this, is that I am learning a lot. When I got that Fusion 360, I thought, oh, I'm gonna just fucking pop up whatever I want, design whatever I want. Next thing you know, I'm having to master the art of 2D sketching before I even move on or even think about moving on to 3D, what is that called? Parametric modeling.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing is you started by learning how to create something in the 3D realm before you learned before you got into the actual printing part of things.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you printing out custom cases yet for your Pi 3 main builds?
Not yet. Actually, I ordered I ordered some digital caterpillars online the other day. I just got them today, so I'm gonna have to start measuring everything. But I will be designing those in the near future. I'm sorry, pardon my Spanglish here for a bit. But that's what I've been planning on, just doing mobile 3D Pi builds, where the retro Pis, and just start fleshing some of those out where people can carry those around and make some sort of Swift knockoff at a much cheaper price.
You know, looking at making like a little Game Boy style, but with like the six buttons type of a deal, or like a little mobile wannabe cabinet style. You know, like you can buy them for like 30 to like 20 bucks or something like that, where it's got the little remote and it almost looks like one of the old arcade machines.
Well, it's pretty much going to be a mesh of those two. I want the full features of basically a PlayStation controller, you know, where you have all the shoulder buttons and the trigger buttons. So my customers would have a bigger selection of games to play with, not just Nintendo, but also PlayStation and all the other fun games out there, do some Neo Geo and all that fun stuff. But I'm having a lot of fun learning about this 3D printer. It's even my boys all like, hey man, come on.
If I send you some stuff and some cash, can you print me out some stuff?
For sure, Joe. As soon as I figure out how to properly build something sturdy on this 3D printer, I can definitely print you out some stuff. I just ordered some more PLA off of Amazon. I took advantage of that Amazon Prime Day. I got $20 spiels for $10 a piece.
Yeah, I got to get mine up and rolling again. I'm sitting on a mountain of freaking PLA, and I can't do anything with it until I get my printer back up.
Yeah, I know you jumped on to hear about that venue, Chris.
Say that again, Joe.
I know you jumped on to hear about getting the sound working on that Dell.
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, my time is almost up, man. So if you can give us the highlights of it, I'd like to follow your lead on that, because I do have that Dell Pro, and I've been meaning to change the operating system on it. And get something better working than that old Windows 8 operating system it has.
Yeah, well, once I got the Linux Mint on there, that wouldn't be the newest one, which is now 19, but this would be 18.3. The sound wasn't working, first off. And then I did a couple of updates, restarted it, and it was working. And then got me a little excited there for a minute. Then I switched to the headphones and none of the sound was working again, even when I switched it back. It turns out that even after the update, the only thing you really need to be worried about is every time you're going to switch audio headset to the loudspeakers on the side, you have to restart the machine, change the settings, restart the machine, and then it'll work until the next time you want to change audio.
That's actually happening already on the current operating system I have. Every time I try to plug in a head jack or an external speaker that doesn't use the factory made speakers on it, I have to restart my machine, especially when I'm using a VLC media player.
Interesting.
Joe, what are you using to switch outputs? Is it like a pulse audio volume control or something inside the machine?
That is correct. Pulse audio volume control.
Okay, see, that's why, you know, when I jumped in and Honky said, hey, you know, I didn't get back to him because everything was coming out my, you know, the onboard speakers and microphone, and I had to go, you know, load pulse PAVU, switch everything over. Of course, you guys heard me, you know, pretty much every time I join the cast, I have to do that. So, yeah, but I've never had to reboot. So this must be a quirk of this particular Dell.
Well, it is a tablet, so I'm not surprised that it's quirky. It's last time I let it go to sleep, it didn't come back from sleep either, so I'm going to have to adjust the settings there. And then I think the next thing I'm going to start plucking away at is the Bluetooth. It doesn't acknowledge that it has Bluetooth on board at all, so I'm missing some drivers there, and I'm going to have to look around and see if anybody else has gotten it working. But last time I looked, nobody had. So it's a great little Linux Mint 8-inch tablet now.
What are you doing with it right now?
Well, I just got the audio working on it today. I mean, I also have X2Go set up on it, and I'm going to put PyCharm and SimpleNote on it. And then I'll probably start taking it to work with me just to record daily notes on.
Now, how expensive is this beat?
I'm not sure. I mean, you can only get them used anymore. I don't think they make the 8-inch Dell Venue. I know that.
Yeah, they don't make that anymore. I got it at the tail end when they were making them. I think I paid like $100 for it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, when I got mine, we got 5 tablets together, and 2 of them were the like $40 Android tablets, and one of them was one of the original iPads, like the iPad 1, and this Dell Venue Pro 8, and the wife paid $150 for the lot of them. Oh no, she says $100 even for the lot of them.
Yeah, but for the price, that little processor on there is amazing, and I'd like to keep using it until it dies on me.
By the way, I don't work for this company, but I think pluggable.com will give you some expansions for that Dell Venue.
Yeah, they did make a specific docking station for it that would hook up over OTG. And I have some really nice OTG connectors that allow power to pass through. And then you hook up really any external USB hub that's powered, and it works awesome.
Hook it up, Joe. Hook it up. My birthday's coming up in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, I got plenty of those adapters.
Well, the pluggable people were doing stuff with the tablets because I keep an eye on them because they're back when I was using Windows, I had some decent USB 2 video, actually separate docking stations. I originally hoped that they would work on Fedora multi-seat, but evidently that's gone away.
Yeah, today I just picked up this AOC 15.6-inch USB-powered monitor. And while we've been sitting here, I put in the DisplayLink drivers on my laptop and got it all set up, and I am really liking it for a portable monitor. So probably next time I end up working from home, I'm going to set it up and do 2 monitors instead of just my laptop.
Which USB does it use?
It's this one's USB 3.0.
Okay. Just that I have USB 3.0 on some of my desktops, but I don't have it on my laptop.
I'm also thinking I could hook it up to my Asus Transformer, which has USB 3.0 on the dock, the keyboard dock, which would be interesting.
And you're running it under what, Linux?
Linux Mint 18.3. And I was kind of surprised that the DisplayLink drivers worked, because usually you can't use them in conjunction with the proprietary drivers for the GTX line, and it worked just fine this time.
Well, I'll have to see. I have a machine I could use a second monitor on that has USB 3 capabilities, but it's an early APU machine. Doesn't have a video card in it, and I'd rather not put a video card in it.
Then DisplayLink is definitely the way to go. I know that there are a couple of docking stations out there that are USB 3.0, and they come with their own power supply. And it's one of the ThinkPad ones that I have out in the garage, and I got it for like $15, and it comes with two DVI outs, and then I just use adapters to get it to either HDMI or VGA. But that works great with the DisplayLink drivers.
Well, that's the kind of stuff that Pluggable specializes in. I'm just saying that I've had good luck with them, but I've only worked with them under USB 2.
Yeah, with DisplayLink, I think the only thing I've used is USB 3.
As to used price, while we've been talking, I was looking, just real quick check, saw one on Amazon for neighborhood of $150, and then looking at eBay, the cheapest ones on Buy It Now seem to be hovering around $55. Little more, maybe.
Yeah, when I bought mine, I was able, the ThinkPad model, I was able to find it without a power supply, and it was $15. And then I went back later and bought the power supply, and that was a standard ThinkPad power supply, so it came out to like another $15, which is a lot less than what one would cost with the power supply.
Yeah, sounds like you got a pretty sweet deal. Yeah, that's something, that's always a habit of mine, and why I wind up with a house full of too much crap, or too much stuff, sorry, is people talk about something, I'll look at that and say, well, that sounds interesting, you know, let me look around online and see what that would cost, and there were a lot of things have come up, you know, especially the stuff that is dual boot Windows and Android that, you know, no, you just can't install Linux on it because it's already partitioned into 50 partitions, and you know there's no way to get it boot straight up from an SD or a stick drive or anything, so that you could wipe it and put something else on there. So you know, I've looked at several things. It's like nice, you know, interesting, powerful little devices, but there's just no way to get Linux on them.
So this is a touchscreen device, right?
A what?
Touchscreen device, right?
No. This AOC is just a monitor.
No. Tablet.
Dell Venue Pro 8. And yes, it's a touchscreen device. And the only other complaint I have is not being able to right-click on the screen.
So I think there's ways you can do that.
There should be. I just haven't gone through it yet and found it. So my focus on it when I've worked on it for the last couple of weeks when I've had time was getting the sound working.
On the current OS I'm using, it's just a hold for 2 seconds to get the right click option on it.
Yeah, that hasn't worked so far with Linux Mint. I'm gonna have to see what other people have done to set it up that way. Honky, you had a question?
I would just so Mint plays well with touchscreen devices.
So far, I mean, that's what I'm using.
Now, is that Wayland or X11?
That would be X11, because I haven't updated to 19 yet, so it's not using the newest from Ubuntu, so it should be the older X11.
Well, it's been at least a couple years since support for touchscreens was, you know, was support supposedly officially supported by Linux. Are there distros out there that it's still particularly difficult to get a touchscreen working?
I'm not sure, but I know that the Linux Mint, at least the left click, has worked as soon as I turned it on the first time. Even when it was just the live CD mode so that I could install it, it was working fine.
Well, that's big.
And one thing I just wanted to point out, I think anybody listening to it's probably caught that, but this is a device set up to, at least with the original OS, support a stylus, and I guess you guys have got it going. So, you know, most of my normal stuff, that's not something that would be important to me, but all these people have come in this week, you know, prove they've been there. They have their business thing, you know, signed with a stylus. So if that's your business model or something like that, you're doing stuff on the cheap, this may be something to look at.
Now, does it react well with, like, as soon as you touch a box? So it would be kind of like how Android does it, where as soon as you touch it in a box where you need to type something in, an on-screen keyboard could come up?
I know that there is a way to do that. I don't have mine set up that way. What I have done is, in the taskbar, I've made it so that the on-screen keyboard is always there, and so I just have to click up in the top right corner and it comes up. It takes up the bottom half of the screen, or not the bottom half, but like the bottom quarter of the screen, and it readjusts the size of everything else, and I can just type from there and close it out when I'm done.
That's awesome. Sorry, I haven't had much experience with Linux and touchscreen devices, so.
Neither have I, and I wanted to, so I started.
And even with Android, I don't know if I would rather have a discrete thing to turn the keyboard on and off, because sometimes it gets obtrusive, and what I really hate is you have an interface, usually it's a web interface, you're trying to fill out a form, and there's absolutely no way to scroll down and complete the form on an Android device.
Thank you, Joe, for being the leading enterpriser in this touchscreen and Linux Mint.
Well, on the back of giants type of thing there, I did a lot of reading up on other people that have done the exact same thing with that exact same device.
You know, Dan's going to accuse you of doing tech stuff again this week.
Actually, I've got an old e-machine, and I'm wondering if it would be better to run a USB video than try to use the second port on the video card.
Well, if it's got onboard graphics, it's probably better to use the one that's already in there as opposed to going over USB, which would offload all of the video processing to the processor. Right?
Well, I don't know how it is now. I know when Linux first started support, USB video, you probably want to relegate that to pretty much static things, static web pages, you know, no video or anything, because that is going to crunch it down. Because I always buy stuff that's not ready, and I got a USB screen. And then, you know, kept waiting for, because Linux was supposed to be supporting it, kept waiting, and then, you know, had all that stuff happen to all my old equipment and lost it all before that even came to fruition. But that's been a few years ago. I'm assuming now is at least usable, though, like I said, probably Netminder, you're going to get better performance on a native video card, even if it's a built-in one. Than over USB.
Yeah, the machine that I'm really focusing on Well, I have two possible machines. One where my video card is already, all the IOs are taken up and it has USB 3. Actually, the primary screen has USB 3 on it, so that might make things interesting. And second, I have a machine which has only one video output for the onboard, and putting an auxiliary monitor on it would be nice, especially if I can just get any USB 3 display link to work.
Well, the drivers will work. As to performance, I'm not sure. I mean, I've got mine hooked up to my MSI GE72, and it's working fine.
Hey guys, sorry to bell on you, but I'm late for my karaoke session for tonight, and people are already bugging me to, they're like, where you at, Chris? Where you at? Where you at? It's just nice talking to you guys. 50, man, go see your doctor, bro. Joe, thanks for having me.
Hey, come on back anytime.
Yeah, Elminster Bookworm, thanks for coming in. Always glad to. Well, of course, Bookworm's been here before, but you know, seeing faces beyond the sort of core group. I hope we can keep building this up, and don't be strangers. And I, you know, like I said, I hope I didn't take this too far off into too much time spent in non-tech territory tonight.
Nah, 50, you're cool, man. Just remind us once again not to ask you about your day again.
Yeah, that's going to be that rule will go back into effect now. Though I could do without this guy on eBay. See, I live in a near unincorporated town called Cairo, Kansas, spelled like Cairo, Egypt. And so I've got a thing on eBay to you know, for a hit on anything that might you know, to do with Cairo, Kansas. And for some reason, once again, I keep getting this joker who wants to sell me a Cairo Ren Star Wars figure.
I'm sorry, man. I'll stop bugging you about that. I'll find somebody else to buy it from me. Anyway, though, guys, y'all have a good night. Joe, I'm going to have to get back to you on that Dell, man, because I'm ready to switch OSs on it. Talk to y'all later.
Have fun with your karaoke.
Yeah, I can't do that.
Bookworm, have a good night.
Thanks, y'all too.
All right, 50, what do you have for links here?
Okay, now the first one, and like I said, that link's a little out of date. What this whole we haven't got a chance to talk about it since I think the show before the last show, I talked about the thing that of course in Europe they don't have the same fair use laws that we have, so that you can take a paragraph out of something and quote it as long as you didn't quote the whole article. You know, and people have been doing stuff like Xeroxing magazine articles and handing them out as class materials. You know, and this was what I talked about a few weeks ago, you know, copyright rules, trying to change copyright rules in the European Union. So you couldn't, you know, you couldn't Xerox anything from anything and use it for anything without the original author's permission. But what they were coming down to, they were set, and, you know, they're trying to I see how they're trying to protect their, you know, few remaining and dying print outlets, or print out, I guess in this case, print outlets with a network presence. But this same copyright rule, among other things, would have required, not given the publisher an option, would have required a publisher to charge if somebody posted a link to one of their articles. So, you know, let's say it's the British newspaper that was in contact with Snowden. Not the Herald, something like that. But, you know, I've posted links, you know, articles about Snowden in this British newspaper. You know, and I assume probably that it can't be enforced beyond Europe. But, you know, this perfect example is, you know, I have done this, you know, talked about an article about Snowden. Put the link in the show notes. Show notes get put up on the internet. Well, then these rules changes would not just have given the publisher the right to charge us for using that link. It would require them to charge us for using that link. And we talked about moving, you know, our current hosting stuff. You know, let's say you have the hosting is based in the U.S., but we don't know probably the intricacies of agreements between U.S. hosts and, you know, things in Europe or whatever. So that might be a crapshoot just to post something on a U.S.-based host. But, I mean, I've offered to, you know, host the website on my Scaleway server. No more traffic than there would be over it. That's $3 a month. We've talked about that. And that server is based in Paris, France. So, yeah, that would definitely – if we were to move stuff over and then I were to post, you know, post links – to a European publication, that would expose us to that problem. And there were other things like memes. You know, there are a lot of things. Memes are probably using copyrighted images, especially if they're famous people or whatever. And it was like being called the meme tax that you couldn't, you know, also requiring people that if they're photography or whatever showed up in a meme to track that down to everyone who posted that meme and trying to get money out of them. And I guess there was a third thing that was silly, but those were two main ones. And there was a lot of stuff, you know, another Save the Internet campaign separate from the one, that our friend Chris ran, for the drive
FCC.
Yes, the FCC and the software defined radio drivers and all that. They just happened on the same name. But, you know, again, people looked at this and said, this is going to, if this goes through, this is going to break the internet. And it came to a vote to the European Parliament. And fortunately, it was about 3/5 to 2/5 against. But, you know, that shows – but that's a preliminary thing because that what that does, it doesn't get rid of it, but it throws it back to the author saying, hey, you know, this is not acceptable the way it is. Fix it. And that probably means this is not going to be a problem. But that also means that, you know, like 2/5 of the – you know, nearly half the politicians in the European Parliament – have no concept of how the internet works and, you know, and are willing to do ridiculous things that are going to break it.
Well, this reminds me of the ISO standards for networking. They didn't work, but like X25, they had a lot of stuff about how to get the billing for every packet sent.
And as it happens, like I said, I just got, you know, you know, got home from the hospital a hour before we would have started the last show, and you know, and debate, and if this had still been hanging fire, I would have come on and talked about it if there had been a show. But it, as it happened, I wasn't feeling well. You know, I had a very eventful day, already being tired. You, Honky, we're going to have to get up way early in the morning and leave, and we keep you up too late at night, as it is. On the, you know, so that there was this, Mitch earlier, there was a decision, mutual decision, or I say mutual, probably just mainly you and me. Yeah, let's not do the show the last time. So that's why there wasn't a show 2 weeks ago. But literally that day, that Friday, the European Parliament had the vote and said, no, this is not acceptable in this form. So that doesn't mean they're not going to come back. You know, this is going to go back to them sometime next fall. And it doesn't mean they're going to fix every stupid thing that's in there. Hopefully this is a signal, you know, man, guys, learn how the internet works. You know, you can't do this. And you certainly can't expect to enforce it if you did. But, you know, hopefully that's the message that's been sent. But that doesn't mean that this is not an issue we shouldn't all be watching. Like I said, I would have done the show 2 weeks ago if this had still been an immediate issue, because you know it was okay. Next link, and I guess the only way I would have got around it is the Guardian's publication I was thinking about. You know, I could say on the show, yes, there was a recent article about such and such on the Guardian, but I can't give you the link because they'll charge me to give you the link. And that'd be the way we would have had to have gone. And like I said, not knowing the various corporate relationships between various entities, I would have been, you know, I would have been skittish about publishing something that I thought was a completely an American article on a completely American website, because who knows? Okay, the next one is from Joe C. Hecht, who has been a regular on this show. And if you're not following Joe on G+, you need to, because everything he posts is interesting stuff. Now, some of it is, you know, more geared to being a Delphi developer like he is, but mainly most of the stuff in general, people who listen to the show are going to be very interested. And ostrichnix.com, I'm not going to quote the whole link, will be in the show notes. Linux and Unix operating systems online for free. And essentially, you know, you click, there is probably more than 100 systems, and you click on it, and in your browser, it loads up a virtual machine so that you can try that Linux or Unix and see if it's something you'd be interested in. Now, I haven't got so far as saying get on there and then start installing software. I think you probably could, because it's a total virtual machine. You know, you could get on there, install whatever packages you wanted. I don't know if there are, you know, like for a while, Door was doing all his editing in a virtual machine on a custom system designed for editing. So I don't know if there's anything that specific out there, you know, but I guess you could get on there and make one. Of course, you'd have to do it over again every time. But, and I'm certain it's not nearly as fast as a virtual machine running locally, but you know, if you just want to test drive an operating system without having to do any downloads or messing with or loading it on your system or using your storage or whatever, you know, this just seems like an incredible resource.
Yeah, I actually bought this a couple weeks ago. Well, actually about like 2 months ago, something like that.
Oh, okay. I've probably forgotten it by then.
Yeah, it seems pretty cool, but I think they only give it to let you use it for like a certain amount of time. You can also they also give you a was it BNC address, so you can BNC into the it's an emulated machine. I think they use QEMU. So yeah, it's I tried it out. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, thank you for reminding me of that. Yes, it's definitely your VNCing, and I believe you're right. QEMU is the virtual environment that they're using. I don't know to go too much into detail. Gentel repos were hacked, which means there was, somebody inserted malware into the repo, and apparently it was because of essentially a weak GitHub password. So I don't know if there's too much discussed about that, but everybody says, yeah, trust the repos. Well, sometimes maybe not. I don't know what you can do to get around that, but hopefully the distro developers will, take this as a sign and, exercise their due diligence. This one, I think, also from Joe, and not so much for probably the average user, but it's a $10 Nordic NRF F2840 USB dongle. And what it does, it seems to support a lot of wireless technologies that are not in general use yet, future technologies. So if you want to start experimenting with development for standards that are not in general use, because it says Bluetooth 5, Thread, Zigbee, 802.15.4, ANT, and 2.4 gigahertz proprietary. I don't know exactly what that last one is, but yeah, if anybody knows what these are, this is the USB stick that will bring that hardware into your box.
Yeah, I looked at the page. Right at the moment, it's a naked PCB. In August, they're going to have one in a little case of some kind. And they promise possible certification.
Yes, definitely as it is. This is a developer device. I'm not a developer in those areas by any stretch of the imagination. So like I said, this is not for the general rank and file Linux user anything to be worried about right now. But if you're developing software for these technologies, there's a quick and cheap way to get that hardware on your box, so you're working in an actual environment, not a virtual one. Another one was posted by Joe from It's Foss, and I've seen this posted a lot of places in the last few weeks. Basically, the difference between the Macintosh BSD and the Linux kernels. I don't know if anybody said, Mac and Linux, it's the same thing. Of course, your Mac OS X kernel is BSD at its base. I can't think if Mac OS has been BSD, but yeah, the current Mac kernel is BSD open source at its base. Of course, BSD is not open source in quite the same way. Well, BSD is more what's the word I'm thinking of? But essentially, the thing is, you could take BSD, turn it into something closed source. whereas you couldn't with the Linux license. What am I thinking? I don't want to say promiscuous. That's not the right word.
Yeah, it can be privatized. BSD licenses can be privatized.
Right, yes. I can't think. But, you know, BSD itself, of course, is open. But, you know, just the differences between the monolithic and the modular kernels and all that, it you know, really good explanation going through that. No, the Mac BSD kernel is not like the Linux kernel. And I can't imagine anybody saying that it is like, except the fact that they are both, you know, BSD is nominally open source, or a lot of people say it's more open than Linux in a way. It depends on which side of the fence you're on that, but does go through in operation what the differences are.
Also, the Mac kernel at the low level is based on Mach, M-A-C-H, from Carnegie Mellon. So it's, that's where you get the modularity and the process-based kernel instead of a monolith. But you can also run your Mac OS without the pretty shell, and you end up with something they call Darwin.
Yeah, in fact, one of the first Techie Geek episodes, not the first one he did, first one I started listening to, and I think they're all still out there to find. If not, I've got to save somewhere. But it was what you would have to do. Of course, you know, they hired another Steve, not Steve Jobs, Steve, the guy that went off and did Next.
That is Jobs.
No, Steve Wozniak. No, I guess you're right. Was it Steve that went off and did Next? Jobs that went off and did Next? Okay. But I guess they hired him back just essentially to get the Next operating system, which became OS X. But, Techie Geek years ago did a thing, you know, how to take an old Mac and do this and do that to make it look like the next, you know, the next Cube operating system rather than the Mac operating system, because all the bones were still in there. And that was something I wanted to do at the time, and I'll have to look up that old episode, grab one of my old Macs and do, well, of course, I don't know if any of my old Macs run it late enough, but there. Well, I think the Okay, all the PPC Macs and the Intel. I don't know if the Intel Macs do it. You would want a PPC Mac, and that's what I have a bunch of. So, yeah, there's a way to go back and, you know, do this, do that to that OS, and make it look just like, or pretty much just like a Next Cube.
Speaking of copyright and Next, somebody did a patch to Y2K, the Next operating system, you know, to clean it up. And evidently, for copyright reasons, somebody got pissed. So if you run a Next machine, you have to run 19XX dates, because you can't patch the date it to be Y2K compliant without the gods of Apple or Next coming after you.
Oh, isn't that always the case? The digital bureaucracy you know, overloads over common sense? I mean, how are Apple or anybody, still trying to make money off the next operating system?
Yeah, well, also, they've not got a sunset clause on intellectual property. That's the problem.
Okay, let me go back and see what the next link I had. That may have been the last. I have some cool stuff I want to talk about that is technology related, not necessarily open source. If, you know, your general folk will give me that indulgence for a couple minutes. Probably the most recent thing on... Still have the Samsung. Now, I am not going to open that one back up because that was the one who was wanting to run a video and talk to me. I swear the first time I had that open, it actually had text that explained what the problem was. For most of us listening to the podcast, it's not a problem. It is not the base operating system, but on Samsung app, which probably most of us would run kicking and screaming away from. A messaging app that would send your pictures and mainly pictures, I guess, to some random person in your contact list. You know, so perhaps private pictures, you know, things you probably would not be one to share with your friends. Who knows? I say don't put that kind of thing on your phone if you don't want it shared with the entire world. But I'm certain this probably, you know, was embarrassing for a few people who sent naughty pics to their grandmother or something. But I believe it was a totally opt-in Samsung app. So if you never use that app, then you're not going to get hit with this bug. It's not, you know, it's not an Android bug. It's a Samsung app bug. But that, you know, that a few weeks ago came across the internet for a while as an issue. And I have a Samsung phone. I looked this up. Oh, okay. You know, not an app I've ever used, not an app I would ever use, so I don't have to worry. Okay, then we get to the non-FOSS stuff real quick. I did go on, you know, quote, Amazon Day, or Prime Day, rather, and I'm an Amazon Prime member, was last week. Best thing I saw on that was, I think this holiday has gotten away too much from the hero who died to give his name to the holiday. And they showed a picture of dying Optimus Prime from the animated Transformers movie 30 years ago. So I went on. Did not see a lot of stuff I could really justify. Saw a couple things that I bought anyway because I couldn't justify them. But it was a deep discount, I guess. So, and it just came today. I got the Echo Show and a Fire TV Cube. And what the Echo Show is, like the highest end Echo with a screen on it. So that pretty much I just had to go through, you know, link it to my Amazon account. Did want you to put the Amazon Echo app on your phone or an Android device so it would pause while you went and did that. I mean, you could hit skip. But I guess there's some, you know, there are some settings, and definitely you could interface some of the Amazon Show functions from your phone or Android device. And it's like any one of these other things. I've got the Google Home, you know, minis, and, you know, you talk to it, and mainly, of course, their end of it is they want you to order the, I have not really started, you know, I order electronics and stuff from Amazon. I do not order, you know, household goods. I don't order flour. I don't order frozen burritos or whatever, you know, this is what they're wanting you to really do with these things. And, you know, with the screen, you can, you know, you communicate with other folks that have these, I guess, you know, as a video telephone. And there's like drop-in mode. You just dial people. And that was a concern, I think, when they first came out, that people were able to dial and then get the video feed from somebody without getting their permission first. Sort of a glitch. So, you know, you click on grandma and there's, you know, grandma just got out of bed. You won't go, ah! Or maybe you just got out of bed and grandma calls you, you know, which would probably be worse. There's always the privacy concerns there, but, you know, everybody says, well, you know, if you've got a smartphone, unless you beat it over a rock, you've got the exact same privacy concerns as you do having a, you know, the Google Home or the Echo or, you know, the Mycroft or whatever, you know, in your home. But I've got it set up. I've asked it to play, you know, and unless you buy this like $8 a month or whatever service, you know, that would get you any song ever made, I have been able to play stuff more than I have been able to play through the Google Home. You know, Google Home says, yeah, you need to subscribe to whatchamacallit on Yahoo or whatever, then we can play whatever music you asked for. But no, that popular song that you want me to play, that's behind the firewall where you got, or the paywall where you got to pay more. Same way with the Echo, but they're, you know, it's a little more flexible. A lot of it's like, well, we'll play you a clip from the song, but we won't play the whole song. It will play Amazon Video over it. I don't know, or Amazon Prime Video. I don't know why you'd want to watch Amazon Prime Video on an 8-inch screen. And unfortunately, with their fight with Google right now, you can't just say, well, yeah, play this video and throw it at my Chromecast. Unfortunately, and this has been my point, until these things are, you know, cross-platform, ubiquitous, you know, they all work together with each other, this whole technology is not going to come to fruition unless it's completely transparent, you know, who you're buying it from. At least I don't think so. I also got the Fire TV Cube, and, you know, and again, because of this fight with Google, it's not complete because you can't do YouTube on it, but you plug it into one of your HDMI inputs, and then pretty much it's set up whatever service you're subscribed to, if it's Hulu or Netflix or Amazon Prime or the standalone Showtime or HBO services, HBO Now, whatever. You know, you just put all your credentials for all that stuff in. And supposedly, you know, if you want to see a movie, you just say, and like I said, it's HDMI right into your TV and voice controlled. But if you want to see a movie, you just say the name of the movie and it will figure out which service supports that movie. Now, one thing I'm concerned about right now, I'm getting my Showtime and my HBO through Hulu. So it understands basic Hulu. I don't know if it understands HBO on Hulu. So if I tell it Game of Thrones, you know, it's probably going to look for Game of Thrones at least first under HBO via Amazon Prime and then under HBO Now. Will it find it under HBO Hulu? I guess if not, then maybe if the price per month is comparable, maybe, you know, cancel those external services on Hulu and move them over to Prime. Of course, that then, you know, right now with them on Hulu, I could do them on about any TV I wanted. If I move it over to Prime, then it's going to be through that cube. One thing that may help, I think I did mention a few weeks ago, I think I wore out the button on my remote on my smart TV that launches Amazon. And I said, okay, well, I got another Amazon stick online. And as soon as I put it in, the remote, you know, the one from the remote started working again. So, okay, so I moved that off to the, you know, TV in the garage if I need it, if I want to watch something on Prime out there. And as soon as I did that, then the button on the remote quit working. So, you know, I can throw all that garbage over through this little cube thing. Except, of course, YouTube. If I want to watch YouTube, I'll have to switch the input to Chromecast. So, you know, and a lot of this, would, you know, when they're on sale and whatever, I get these things partially so that I can report back on them and at least contrast, you know, these proprietary things to the open source alternatives, though I would be very surprised if both these devices weren't running some form of Linux or Android at the bottom. I do know the Amazon Fire is a modified Android, though this, you know, when you boot up the Seco Show, it, you know, it says Intel inside. So, you know, maybe it's Linux, maybe it's something different, maybe it's something completely proprietary Amazon has come up with. Let's see, the next one I thought was really interesting project, and even though they were using Windows, I don't see why you couldn't do the exact same thing under Linux. It's just the hardware, the drivers, but it's using AI as a sort of radar to see through walls, to see, you know, to see people walking around on the other side. So, you know, that's a link in the show notes I'll leave out there. I just thought that was interesting that that could be done. I've seen stuff on, you know, doing your own radar or, you know, building your own radar using consumer parts or whatever and Wi-Fi parts. So this just seems like it's a progression on that. And then the other thing, China develops a laser ray gun, and this is not like Star Wars ray gun, but it might give you like a sunburn and make you feel sick. I think it'll make you feel nauseous. So it's like a non-lethal weapon that China has developed, but, you know, they can point it at you and you're not going to be able to fight. You know, you're going to be a prisoner. So, again, nothing in there is probably, I mean, you know, maybe it's China. They very well could be basing it on open source technology. I don't know. I think it's more the article's more in the hardware than the software that controls it. But, yeah, I just thought, okay. If it works, kind of cool and interesting, a new thing, a different thing, you know, first step in non-lethal beam weapons. That could be an interesting change. I mean, for both law enforcement and the military. So definitely something I think most people would be interested in taking a look at. And again, all in the show notes. Okay, that is all the links I had, guys. Sorry if I got too long-winded on that.
No, that's fine. I think somebody's been sitting outside of my work and shooting that ray gun at me right before I go into work.
Well, at least you could use that as an excuse. I mean, we've heard of people, you know, we've heard of things, you know, like this, you know, on a bigger scale being pointed at embassies. But, you know, yeah, if that'll work with your boss, I'm sorry, I gotta go home. It's those darn Chinese
hiding outside in the bushes, pointing those ray guns at us.
And next month we're going to get all kinds of letters about how we are racially insensitive. The article says China, you know, but I'm not mean to single anybody out and making them look to be insidious or something like that. I mean, you know, it's a non-lethal weapon, you know, shoot. Let's all get those.
Right.
Okay. You had some links, Honky?
Yep. So first one was the I said a while ago that I had bought the Orange Pi R1, which is the Orange Pi with two NICs on it. They're only they're not gigabit, they're only 100 megabit per second gigs, the NICs, because I think they run on the USB bus like the Raspberry Pi does too. But the idea being that if you're going to use it for something like a firewall, that more than likely the speeds you're getting up and down aren't going to be that significant anyways, that that's going to hinder it too much. I have played around, so my idea for it was to try to use it as a firewall, and two of the distributions that are available for it are the, you know, standard OpenWRT and a new one that I really haven't seen before called Zero Shell. And Zero Shell has a lot more, like, OpenWRT is more like a router based, and then you can kind of build more stuff like Snort and stuff like that on top of it, but it's not like set up initially for that sort of a thing. While Zero Shell seems to be geared more towards being a firewall and has a lot of things like intrusion detection and things like that pre-installed on it, and is set up ready to configure all that stuff. So I've just installed it. I had it installed for a little while. I've played with it a little bit. I've done some mild speed tests. I'm not sure. I've talked about it before on my network. I have modem. I have a router, and then I have that router is kind of like my DMZ, and then it'll go into another router. So I put the Orange Pi R1 into the DMZ area, and then I just kind of hooked it into the first router, and then I hooked it up to a laptop, and then the laptop I was trying to see what my do a speed test, and I don't know which speed test it is. I just, when I go into Google, I type in speed test and something comes up automatically, and so I ran a couple of tests. And on like one laptop that I have connected to the wireless router, which is the last router on the thing on my network, I was getting 12 down and 5.9 up. And on the one that was behind the R1, I was getting anywhere between 5.9 to about 4.8 down, and then about like 5 up. So the up didn't change at all, but the down seemed to have. And this is just like initial tests and playing around with it. So I want to switch it to other machines too and test it and make sure it's not about an issue with the laptop. But I mean, it seems pretty cool. I might try OpenWRT as well and see how what I get for speed tests out of that. But I had never seen Zero Shell before, and figure I would put it out there, and maybe somebody else can check it out too.
From a quick glance at it, this is a Linux-based pfSense.
Exactly.
Well, I wonder if it is the a port of the pfSense that was on the Texas Instruments There was a ARM-based pfSense box you could buy, but you could not get the ARM-based software separately. In other words, you couldn't download the ARM. So when you're saying this is ARM-based pfSense, do you mean that literally, or do you mean it's like pfSense?
It's like pfSense.
Yeah, it's a Chevy to pfSense's Ford.
Okay, so it you know, it's more of a point and click like IPFire and pfSense. Okay, and graphically based, because you know, like OpenDRT. You know, I think you could make a great firewall out of that, but you got to know what you're doing. It's not like, you know, stick it on there, not modify anything, and not touch it, or you know, or if you want, like you said, if you want to add Snork to it, you got to know how to do that. You can't just click a deal and say start Snork.
Well, OpenWRT, which is why it's supported on. It's actually available. I think there are versions that actually come with some commercial routers. It is designed to take the limited router that everybody buys at, you know, Best Buy or whatnot, and squeeze as much capacity and performance out of that little moron as possible. This is designed to take a computer and give you a router that Cisco or Juniper or name somebody else would charge you good big bucks for.
Yeah, the one thing about this that I'm noticing is it's like I've played with IPFire before. I don't think I've played with pfSense, but I played with IPFire before, and IPFire was pretty straightforward, like right off the bat. Like, this is what is the different colors they use, the red and the blue, or red and green. This one is this input is this, this input is that, and then everything from there is kind of straightforward. This, as soon as you start it up, almost looks like the kitchen sink. I mean, if whatever it is you want to do just seems to be just configurations. And I have, like, I've basically just put it on the micro SD card, plugged it in, and then it's a web-based application, and I went to the web-based thing, and I've kind of clicked around some of the menus, but I have not, like, tried setting anything up yet, because I'm not even sure where exactly to start. It's not a simple operating system program firewall. It looks like the kitchen sink, and you gotta go in there and build something with it.
Now, Rich has talked about, like, on his Orange Pies, you know, he starts using them for stuff. He has a lot of overheating and crashing problems. Have you tested yours extensively enough to whether you think you're going to run into that or not, or going to have to take a fan and point it at it?
I mean, if I touch a thing right now, it's definitely warm, but it doesn't, you know, I'm not doing it. Then again, like I said, I'm not doing much of anything to tax it right now. I don't think it's doing anything right now. I don't think I even have anything pointed to it at the moment. But, I mean, it's definitely a little bit warm. If that becomes an issue, then I'll think about that then. But, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, because, you know, Rich has come, you know, not just stuff locked up, but actually, you know, fried the little computer and had to go start over again on some of his stuff. So, you know, that's just... you know, I'm glad to have you test it first, because I'd hate to get mine set up, get it all burned up, and then that, you know, of course I'd always have consumer routers, whatever, get myself back online, you know, so I could order different parts. But something like that, definitely you want to be redundant, so you don't have to wait till you get to the parts or go on your phone and order a new router or something. But you know, it's definitely an interesting idea that I'm going to follow. And I might see if you know, I had that router based Banana Pi Pro, or it's not a Banana Pi Pro, it's a Banana Pi router version, and all it ever had was open WDRT, and somebody said, no, you don't want to put that on there, and then have to figure out how to configure it. So, well, no, it wasn't that. I never could find it. There was a download for it, but you get it on there, and I could never find any place that told me what the password was. That was it. So, I'll have to look at that Zero Shell website and see if there's a build. It may be way too far in the past. I don't think they make them anymore for that old Banana Pi Pro. Or Banana Pi router. That could solve a lot of problems. What I did do, I had mentioned, it's not really a waste. I got this Jetway NF9VT-930. It's an Intel Celeron computer, quad core. And I looked at it, and it had five RJ45 jacks. I said, okay, yeah, this would be great to put pfSynths on. But I should have looked a little closer. It's one NIC, and the other RJ45 are serial port. And apparently, you know, some stuff like, professional grade routers, like, what am I trying to think of? They had serial interfaces, but it would be, you know, the old serial parts RS-232 or whatever on one end of the cable, and then RJ45 on the other end, on the router end to plug in, but it would be a serial connection. And I guess what this is so you wouldn't have to have a special made-up cable. You know, you could just use regular Ethernet. But this machine has one Ethernet RJ45 and four serial RJ45, which in no way can be configured, you know, as additional NICs. So that's okay, because...
Wait a minute. Actually, they can be.
They can be?
Yes. What you have there is a PPP server.
Well, I thought maybe there was a way to do it if I knew what to do. Of course, you know, I don't know if the throughput would be as good as having actual NICs.
Oh, definitely not. If it's got a USB port, you can do better.
Keep hitting the wrong key. I don't know why. It does have one USB 3, and I saw some people, you know, that you could get local network speeds off the USB 3 to RJ45 adapter.
That would be where to go, at least for big stuff. Now, your Raspberry Pi with appropriate level converters will be glad to talk to all of those serial ports. So if you want to use them for things like Raspberry Pis, which have a serial port on board and will do a serial console easily, that's one possible use of all those extra ports.
Well, actually, what I thought I would probably do, I figured when I get my perimeter security cameras up and running on the house, zone minder. I don't think that is going to work on a Pi on top of it being a file server and whatever. Maybe not. It just seems like anything video would be a little more hungry. So, you know, I've already, you know, figured what I'm not using the, quote, dining room TV as a TV, you know, have it split up into four or five screens, you know, monitoring the perimeter cameras using ZoneMinder. And I thought that, you know, take this board and put it on the back of the TV would probably be the use for it. You know, have plenty of power for that. Well, I said, you know, it was about, it was a neighborhood of $100, a little more. Of course, I'd have to add in memory. It uses one stick of notebook memory and external, or it can use an external power supply. It also could be hooked up to conventional ATX power supply, but you know, there's a coax port on it for an external power supply as well. So, you know, I just figured it uses a bare computer, but replace my Pi server with that and have a little more, you know, have plenty of power. But I've been thinking I would want a dedicated server for ZoneMinder anyway. This seems like a pretty good, you know, I screwed up, did not do my proper research, but still, there's, you know, I probably have a use for this box. Oh, Honky, you still haven't talked about Linux poster or Lyrics poster, have you? And I looked at that connection. That is neat.
Yeah, I saw that. What is it? I don't know. I forget what the website was, but I saw that that posted, and I just thought it was cool and wanted to share it. It's an open source program web app that lets you recreate a photo with text. So basically, one of the things that they do, but the main idea of it was to take like all the lyrics for a song and then add it to like the cover of the song, and then it makes a cool little picture. I think it was a blog post from Ask Ubuntu or something like that. Either way, I thought it looked really cool and I wanted to share it. Check it out. Apparently, you can just throw any sort of text, and I think you just throw any text and any picture together, and as long as there's enough text to be able to do it, I guess it'll render the text. It'll render the image with the text.
Yeah, and what Honky's talking about, it is, well, it's kind of a fusion. You know, if you see one of these pictures, if you drill down, it's made up of a bunch of other little pictures or text or something like that. It's kind of like that. It's not like it's just a picture and it throws text all over it. You know, it's kind of using the text to make the picture.
Right. That's explaining it a little better.
So, you know, click on the link. You know, if it's at all foggy to you, click on the link and it shall all be explained.
Right.
And they say nothing is done. Nothing is uploaded to their end. It's all script put on your browser or what have you and run locally. It's run at your end, not their end.
Okay, is that all the business for this evening?
Just one last quick thing. I didn't put a link up for it, but I like to automate most of this process of editing the audio files, and there's also a script that that was put out by the guys at archive.org. It's a Python script that does the uploading for you. It's called IA. I should probably put a link in the show notes. I didn't think I had a decent link, but either way, I just want to point people to it because it's a good little program. I want to incorporate it into my whole, like right now I have a bash script that does all the audio editing and adds all the metadata and stuff like that with the help of Dave Morris, which I ran into some problems with trying to get this running, and I had actually hit up Dave Morris because I know the Hacker Public Radio works with that they've put all of their archive into archive.org, and they do that with a script. And I know there was two different ways to do it with the this .ia script, the Python script, and there's a way to do it with curl. And I was asking him how they did it, and he was a big help with that. And I've got to, so after some struggles and whatnot, my biggest struggles with it was with Python, because the whole fun of, is it a Python 2.7 or which version of Python is it that it wants? It wants something, I think it wants something older than, it wanted an older version of Python or a newer version of Python. So I had to install Python 3, and then you got to use pip to install some applications into Python. And so I actually downloaded a program called pip3, which so all you have to do is, instead of pip install, you type in pip3 install, and everything will go straight to Python 3 as opposed to the Python 2. And then also I had to I probably had this saved before we were going to do the other show, but I don't remember right now where I had saved it. But there's also a way to, I had to make Python 3 be the primary Python on on the computer. So when it'll call up just Python, or Python script searches for Python, it goes to Python 3 as opposed to the older version of Python. Give me 2 seconds. Let me see if I can pull that up. If not, Truncate Silence will fix it for me.
Well, I can fill it in. I went to the lyrics poster. I did notice. I don't know. This picture they've got in, looks like it's Latin that they're, certainly doesn't look like any kind of song lyrics I've ever seen. But, essentially what it is, as far as reading it, because there's a black, it's a nighttime picture and there's stuff black on the edges, and it's just, it's enough so you can see the text, but not enough so you can really read it. So it is kind of, it's a off, it's a complementing color that fades into the picture. I mean, it's a really cool effect, but as far as if you're going to try to read this page, no way, even if it was in English, no way you could do it unless you, went into the image and really lightened it up. But definitely, though, that would be a really cool thing for, for a cover page for something.
I went to that lyric post, and I recognized the Latin. There's a bunch of Latin stuff that is basically used to test print systems or whatnot, or just as boilerplate text, and that's what it is. I used to know the name of it, but it's sort of generic Latin that they use in, for formatting, testing, and stuff like that. It just gives you some random generic text, and that's what he's got on that particular page.
Oh, I was just thinking the perfect person I should send this link to is Lost in Bronx. I think he could really go to town using this for cover pages for his stories.
I want to say the person from Askubuntu took their blog post about this program, this application, and basically set it to some picture, so that his entire blog post was the picture.
I guess just for giggles sometimes, you know, we could do an alternate version of the show notes with this.
Please, you're going to drive me back to the hospital.
So searching around, I think I figured out what I did to make Python 3 the primary Python. I think what I had to do was edit the in your home directory the .bashrc file. Yeah, add something to it, which is an alias. So you want to alias Python into Python 3. And after you do that, you basically just save it. And then restart it, and it's supposed to work. I think that's the one that finally got to work. And because I played around with that for a while. Because the setting up the alias, I just struggled with the setting up the alias. I don't forget, like I said, I wish I could remember which one I did, but what you had to do was set up an alias. So when you called up, when you just called up Python, it would call up Python 3 as opposed to the older version of Python. Either way, between calling up the proper version, getting the proper version of Python installed, making sure that it that things get aliased, and so that it actually calls up the Python 3 when it calls up Python, and pip 3 to be able to install things directly to Python 3. Those are all the things you really need to know. And then you're probably going to run into some other problems, but for anything else, you know what? Let me copy this link for installation, which I'm not sure is the proper home for, which was why I didn't put it in the show notes in the first place. But there are certain, to get the script to run, there are certain programs you also need to...
And Honky, before we started the show, you'd asked about X-Do tools. Is that something you want to push off until you understand it better?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, what I was saying, I'd love to be able to use this tool and the bash script and just automate everything. So by the time this show is done, like 2 seconds after it's done, I can just start the whole process of it being sent into being edited and sent to archive.org. And then all I got to do is just reference it in WordPress, and it would be up and, you know, published.
Well, I'm glad everybody's figured out an easier way, because this was, got to be close to 10 years ago now. I don't know. I'm one of the people, if I download a podcast, I never delete it. And there was a call out from HPR at the time. You know, yeah, we want to archive everything on archive.org. And we're looking for help. People have got, you know, still have the downloads, especially. But, you know, use your upload time to upload stuff to archive.org. And it was just a mess, and trying to figure out who's going to upload what, and it, well, you know, I was still on my even more laughable previous connection speed, you know, broadband in name only speed. It was like 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi, and I'm on WiMAX now, you know, which is still, compared to everybody else in non-rural areas, it's ridiculous slow. But, you know, I tried to help out, but it was like upload all day and maybe I would get 5-10 episodes. I don't know if I got that much. And it was like I would pick out a block and then somebody else would got to, you know, would get them uploaded way before me. So it was like, no, okay, I give up. So I'm not going to be able to help with this. So, at that time, you know, just some sort of click interface to upload stuff to archive.org would have seemed like science fiction.
Yeah, archive.org is just an incredible site. I mean, if you have money to donate, please donate to archive.org, please.
Oh yeah, I second that, especially since They come through at least once a year, maybe twice. You know, sweetheart donors, which will, you know, contribute you know, I don't know if it's $3 or $4, but for every dollar you contribute, so if you contribute $100, they contribute $400. You know, man, you know, where can you get a value like that?
Right. All right, sir. I think I am tapped out for the night.
Okay. Next recording date will be on. Says 4 May 2018. That ain't right.
That ain't right. August 3rd.
August 3rd. Okay, you're quicker on the draw than I was then. Okay, music is Downright, provided by Klaatu and Brome, and that is such a catchy little tune that they came up with that I never get to hear because I don't generally download and listen to the podcast if I participate. Thanks to Tony Bemis for the Sunday Morning Linux Review for WordPress support and our email list server. I'm skipping over web hosting because I guess not anymore. Not anything against Tony. It's just we've gone a different way. Delwyn for providing the Mumble server and creating the bot module to find the next show recording data. You just go into the hash Linux Lugcast channel on Freenode and type .ns in the IRC command line. Contact us by email at feedback@linuxlugcast.com, and that's still working. There's a G+ link I'm not going to read out. There is the mailing list, which I guess is not working right now. IRC server on Freenode is channel hash Linux Lugcast. Your remaining host for this evening is your host 5150. So long, folks. Also, we've had Honky Magoo who stuck it out.
Good night, folks.
And Netminer.
Yes, thank you, and please, everybody, try to stay healthy.
And
good night.
Yeah, definitely, I will echo trying to stay healthy because not being healthy is no darn fun. Also, on the channel tonight, we who could not stick to the end, probably because my huge long soliloquy about my poor pitiful health problems, my personal pity show. Joe was on with us, and Bookworm and new person, and I hope not the last time he joins us. Help me out, Honky.
Elminster Armoire 030.
Yeah, I just said Elminster because, you know, his handle did get a little bit into alphabet soup at the end, and there's just not enough time in the day. I'm not making fun of you, Elminster. It's just a little hard to pronounce that last part. And really, really, you were real good on here this evening. You brought good content, and I really hope you'll join in with us again at a future date. And all you folks listening, all you friendly folks out there, always remember, you know, we're here for you. We are trying to be your local lug. And you are always, always invited to jump in and participate. And if you can't do that, you know, send us your questions, your comments, your concerns, anything. And we will try to get that handled for you. And so for episode 106, this has been 5150. And since I can't think of anything original, peace out.
Good night, all.
So we're waiting on 50 still, right?
Looks like in for Netminer to return.
What's he doing in the audio test room?
If I had to guess, I'd say testing his audio.
Here's your sign.
But we could hear him just fine.
Yeah, but my guess is he couldn't hear us, so. Netminer, can you hear us?
Hear me.
We can hear you now. We can hear you. You sounded fine before, but you couldn't hear us, I guess.
I don't think he can still hear us, guys.
Can you hear me now?
We can, but it sounds horrible.
Could it be his audio jack?
Most of the time it has something to do with software. Even the 50.
You guys hear me okay?
Yeah, you sound good.
Yeah.
Quite good, 5150.
Okay, I moved to another box. I told somebody I would scan in a picture they found and see if they could identify anybody. But, I scanned it in at, like, the highest resolution, so it's, you know, on my tower. So it's been, you know, hours manipulating the thing. I was going to kill it, but it was ready to finally paste the cropped image, so I've let it do that so I can save it. And welcome this evening, Elminster.
Thank you. Thank you for the welcome. I know Joe is driving, and Netminer's still trying to figure out his audio. What's everybody else doing right now?
Pretty good.
Well, I'm recovering, which most of you guys know, but I'm recovering from blood clots in my lungs. So I'll talk about that when we get to the show.
Pass through the heart and into the lungs?
Must have. They figure they originated in the legs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That happened to my dad.
And I'm over here smoking a hookah, feeling bad.
All right, it's too quiet. Everybody's still here, right?
I'm here.
Okay. Did you not have any show notes for tonight?
The ones I gave you last week or last time before we did.
Oh, you never put them into the Etherpad?
No, probably not. I emailed them to you. Let me go back and find the email.
All right.
Yeah, sorry, I missed last time.
Well, it wasn't the last time because I just got home from the hospital and Honky had to go, had to leave early the next morning.
Well, that explained it. I jumped on for a minute, saw that nobody was on, and then ended up going to Walmart.
And I only jump on when I get invited.
There's no invitation needed, sir.
I'm sorry, say that again?
On the website.
I said there's no invitation needed.
Website says anybody's welcome.
Sweet. Now I got to check out the website.
Blah.
Oh, yeah?
Indeed. I have been doing fun Linuxy things.
Yeah?
Yes.
Do we need to start the show so you can tell us all about it?
Well, it might be better to wait until I actually finish getting home, but yeah, I'm at a comic shop with the wife right now.
Nice.
She was looking for the Injustice versus He-Man, but I guess they're already out.
What is the Injustice?
Injustice League? They're the Justice League, but the opposite.
All the baddies from the Justice League? Taking on He-Man now?
I guess. I don't know a whole lot about it. The wife knows about it.
That is a crossover I would not have seen coming.
Right?
Well, if you want somebody to take on Superman, which is what He-Man's being hired for, you get somebody that can use magic. And if Shazam's not available, you get He-Man.
I could get that one episode of He-Man where he's being a pedophile. It's an old meme.
Has anybody here ever played with X-Dude Tool?
No, what is it?
It's a way to simulate, like, from what I could tell, it's a way to simulate mouse cursor moves by using the keyboard and stuff like that. What I'm trying to do is the left mouse button doesn't work on one of my keyboards. So, I mean, I've just really been tapping, but the problem is every once in a while you need to, you know, click and hold down and drag something. And so I've had to, anytime I want to do anything with that, I've had to attach an external keyboard. What I'm trying to do is remap the left mouse button, left mouse key to something else, and then just so I can actually drag things. So one of the things I found is the X-Dude tool, and I've been trying to find a tutorial on how to get that to work.
Okay, now I know on some of the mice that I've had in the past, the switches do start to wear out. And what you can do to extend the life a little bit is take the mouse apart and put some kind of spacer, usually paper, fold it up, between the actual button and the part that you push down on.
Yeah, something tells me it's going to be a pain in the balls to take this laptop apart, though.
Yeah, it probably would be a pain in the butt.
I've told you about the Toughbook that I had to take apart because if they'd only made the door over the RAM big enough to extract both sticks of RAM, but they didn't. You could only get to one, and the only way to get the other was essentially disassemble the whole thing and flip it over and, you know, pull the keyboard out and flip the motherboard over and pull the RAM off and replace it. And the manufacturer specification said I could go two sticks of two for a total of four. The RAM company, what's their name? They said on that model you could go eight. So I put it together and it would get the grub, but it wouldn't boot into an OS. And it was just so tedious. This is 3 years ago, or 2 years ago. Still haven't got back around to taking it apart again and putting it back together. So whatever it is, I can tell you it could be worse.
Hey guys, I'm back.
Hey, there you are. Can you hear us?
By the way, 50, just to show my solidarity, I went to the hospital on Monday and Tuesday.
Oh, what'd you have done?
Recovery from a total collapse.
Jesus.
Dropping like flies on the show. Him.
What caused that, if you don't mind me asking?
Evidently dehydration, low potassium, and just pushing it, and my body decided, sorry, Charlie, you ain't going.
Yeah, that's how I got medevaced that one time in Korea.
Yeah, dehydration was one of the possibilities I was going over in my mind while I was laying there trying to figure out why I wasn't feeling right.
Well, I'd been pushing fluids, but I think it was the potassium and perhaps not having enough rest.
You know what that means? You need to drink more beer.
Yeah, but my Prozac wouldn't like the beer.
I'm having beer right now.
Besides, my dad had enough of various adult beverages for several generations. Now I'm on Zubuntu 18.04 on this box. Looks like I'm going to be moving off of Sparky if it behaves like it has.
Yeah, I think Zubuntu would be a little more resource hungry than Sparky, but probably not a huge amount. Probably depends on what apps you run.
Well, I have an i5 on this box. My other Sparky boxes are generally dual core or above and don't need pounding. I don't know what's going on, but since it happened on the install on this, the prior install on this machine and the install on my other box, the Netminer 2 box, I think there's an upgrade in my future, especially since I can unsnap this machine. Is to say remove snap capabilities and whatnot, which is why I was staying with a more Debian base.
Now, snaps aren't mandatory, are they? That they were just one of the many possibilities for possible ways of installing applications.
Apt-get is still there, but snap is just as easy.
Yeah, well, I'm old enough to remember snap and its other name. So-called statically linked binaries. Joe, were you in Korea in the service?
What's that?
Were you in Korea in the service?
Yeah. I spent a year at Kunsan Air Force Base, and well, part of that year in Pusan, down on the southern tip.
Well, I just found my dad's discharge papers from the Korean War. Thankfully, he was. Thankfully, he was in Japan at the after the 24th had been withdrawn.
You know, that's where one of my daughters is right now, in South Korea.
Where at in South Korea?
In Seoul right now. Her husband got deployed, and they've got a, he's got a 2 to 3 year contract down there.
Cool. Seoul's not a bad place.
Yeah, from all the pictures I've been getting, I'm like, shit, I want to go. Reenlist.
You going back in?
Oh, hell no, man. I'm too old for that now.
Yeah, my brother was served in Germany and Texas. They denied him some educational grants because he didn't sign up for selective service. The fact that he'd actually served didn't cut any ice.
Really? It always worked for me.
Well, this was a South Carolina drone, I guess. In Florida, they denied him a license because he was ineligible for a green card.
Ah.
You know, American citizens don't need green cards?
Not that I'm aware.
Well, we talk about the limited awareness of bureaucracies all the time.
Last I checked, my dad didn't even have a social security number.
Actually, my dad had a social, his serial number. Well, his military serial number was shorter than a social. So, I may get him a brick on our Korean War memorial if I can gather up the documentation and $100.
It's the documentation that always gets you, man.
Well, since I got his full military history, including a nasty letter from the Army because he owed them $7.50 because he was on a group trip and he'd evidently been overpaid in the 50s.
Oh, he got overpaid on TDY? That happens all the time.
And they'll go after you for every cent.
That's what the nasty letter seemed to say. And since he's buried in West Virginia, I think the brick up here is going to be as close to a tombstone for him as I'm going to have in up here in just south of Boston.
Okay, so what's going on tonight?
Well, 50, you got everything posted in?
Yeah, I got all my notes. I don't think I've saved any links since we didn't have the show the last time.
I got one thing posted in there. I have, like, a couple of other things I wanted to talk about, but I didn't have any, links for any of that stuff yet. That's kind of what I was working on, plus working on the Xdo tool and stuff like that. So, do you want to host?
Sure, I can. Prove I'm still alive. Is there any listener feedback?
That's a good question. Hold on one second.
So, where is the show notes at this time?
I posted it in the Mumble chat. I'll repost it here in a second.
And capitalization does count in Etherpad because you changed the Lugcast wasn't capitalized for 105 and it is for 106. So you can't just change that link. You change the number. You got to change the L too.
Yeah, I saw that. I've been struggling with that. The easy answer to that is if you go to honkymoodygoo.ddns.net/9000/p, then it'll bring you to the Etherpad, just the Etherpad launch page, and then you type in the capital L, Lugcast_106. That'll bring you right to it. But again, the link should basically take you right to it. But yeah, I tried using the old link and then just changing it to 106, and then I just got caught in the loop.
Huh? Maybe because you're local. I didn't get caught in the loop, but it just told me page not found.
All right, anytime you're ready there, 50. Oh, and I didn't find any feedback. Sorry.
No, that's fine. Like I said, people, when we get started, we want to talk about what email links are and are not working again, just so people know.
Okay.
Just a minute. Something on my computer just started talking. Yeah, it was the link about the Samsung error. So I'll keep and looks like there's nothing there but a video, or at least there was text there before. But I think I can talk about that without actually seeing the link. Of course, it's an issue that's a couple weeks old anyway. Okay. Let me stop talking for 30 seconds, and then I'll go into the launch.
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
Oh my God, it's Hacker Public Radio. Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, and that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast, live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net/techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Flying Rich, he's a bloody drunko.
If you don't like a guest, you can get up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that'll get bad.